This is Michael Savage in the Savage Nation. Now I'm saying, what are the odds that the swine flu was created by Islamic terrorists? That they concocted it and planted it in Mexico? Because the Mexicans are the perfect mules for the virus. I'd say the odds are pretty big. That's what I'm saying. And I ain't gonna eat in no restaurants like a moron, cause it's clear to anyone who's not an idiot that Al-Qaeda is using the Mexicans as weapons of mass destruction. We'll be back on the Savage Nation.
We're people gonna rise up, take what's there, cause finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about the revolution.
This week in Radical History for the week starting May 5th. For the next 2 weeks, I'll be traveling, so these next 2 weeks worth of shows are an abridged version of what you've come to know and love. May 19th, I'll be back in the Gleegly Studios, ready to kick it. So until then, enjoy some Radical History. But first, this PSA from 1976.
Yo, check this out, man.
Joe brought it home from the office. He gave it to Betty and one of his kids. And to Betty's mother. But Betty's mother went back to California the next day. On her way to the airport, she gave it to a cab driver, a ticket agent, and one of the charming stewardesses. At school, Joe's kid gave it to some other kids. And Mrs. Merrill got it and gave it to her husband. In California, Betty's mother gave it to her best friend, Dottie. But Dottie had a heart condition and she died. But before she died, Dottie gave it to her girlfriend, the mailman, the paper boy, and the vet when she went to pick up her chihuahua.
If a swine flu epidemic comes, this is how it could spread. You'll want to be protected, especially if you're elderly or chronically ill. Get a shot of protection, the swine flu shot.
The 1976 flu shot killed 10 times as many people who got the vaccine as those who got the flu. Stay informed and check out Radical Thoughts on Emergency Preparedness at aftershockaction.org. That's aftershockaction.org. Now, back to the show.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey, hey.
People, the time has come.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, May 4th in 1855, William Walker, a U.S. citizen, set sail from San Francisco with a small army intending to conquer Latin America. After defeating the Nicaraguan National Army, Walker took control of the country and proclaimed himself president. Guided by his white supremacist beliefs, Walker tried to conquer all of Central America, but military resistance from Central American governments and his U.S. business rivals led to his surrender to the U.S. Navy. He was tried and acquitted on charges of starting an illegal war. During his last attempt to return to Central America, Walker was caught and executed by the government of Honduras. Talk about an inflated sense of entitlement. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on May 4th, 1886, Haymarket Square bombs go off, killing police who are randomly firing into a crowd of protesters. A bunch of anarchists rounded up, arrested, and hung with little to no evidence of involvement. Also on May 4th, 1912, great parade of women suffragettes in New York City organized. Also on May 4th, 1961, freedom rides organized. Many across the U.S. come to southern states to support demonstrations showing the noncompliance of civil rights laws. Also May 4th, 1970, four dead in Ohio. Lastly, on May 4th, 1989, U.S. right-wing sweetheart Ollie North is convicted of the Iran-Contra affair, later pardoned by his boss. That be your friend, George Bush.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Crystal Grant. On this day, May 5th in 1886, the Bayview tragedy occurred during the National May Day labor strike when the U.S. National Guard killed 7 striking workers in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. In the days leading up to this event, 14,000 protesters had shown up at the Milwaukee Iron Company in Bayview, demanding an 8-hour workday. The large number of strikers, who had shut down every business in the city except for one,
prompted the governor of Milwaukee to call in 250 National Guardsmen. The governor gave his order that the guards should shoot to kill any strikers who attempted to enter the mill that morning. When the assembled crowd, including women and children, tried to enter the mill, the guards opened fire. But the killings, known to some as the Bayview Massacre, didn't stop the labor movement. Less than 3 weeks later, some 5,000 workers marched through the streets of Milwaukee. Many American workers now have a standard 8-hour day, but some, including domestic workers and day laborers, are still in the struggle for their basic right. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you never let the past slip away.
Also on May 5th, 1818, future nemesis to anarchist Mikhail Bakunin, communist philosopher Karl Marx is born. Also on May 5th, 1868, Cinco de Mayo, Mexicans celebrate the defeat of the French occupiers. Also on May 5th, 1870, George Washington Revolutionary War Camp mutiny, eventually put down by Pennsylvanian troops. On May 6th, 1877, Chief Crazy Horse surrenders to U.S. troops who later in the year would assassinate him with a bayonet to the back. Also on May 6th, 1915, revolutionary filmmaker Orson Welles is born in Kenosha, Wisconsin. On May 6, 1933, Nazis raid the Institute for Sexual Science in Berlin, Germany, continuing the repression of gays, ending in the forcing of all gays in concentration camps to wear pink triangles as identification. Also on May 6, 1935, Pacific Northwest lumber strikes begin, will involve more than 40,000 workers and end in victory 13 weeks later. Also May 16, 1970, 1 to 2 million students around the country close over 750 campuses around this country in protest of troops being sent to Cambodia. Over 75 campuses will remain closed for the rest of the school year. Also on May 6, 2002, Bush unsigns UN treaty establishing an international criminal court. Bush fears his actions will bring him in front of the court someday.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
On May 7th, 1429, English siege of the French city of Orleans is broken by Joan of Arc. Also on May 7th, 1873, U.S. Marines land at the Bay of Panama to start to take over the country to protect U.S. interests. Also on May 7th, 1937, U.S. invades Nicaragua to protect U.S. interests. Also on that date, 1937, over 500 anarchists killed during street fighting on the streets of Barcelona, including members of the American Lincoln Brigade volunteers who are fighting the fascists. On May 7th, 1942, over 100,000 U.S. citizens that happen to be Japanese Americans suspected of spying are rounded up and put into concentration camps in the U.S. Also on May 7th, 1965, Bloody Sunday in Selma, Alabama, as state troopers attack civil rights marchers. Also on May 7th, 1975, Vietnam War officially ends. Also on May 7th, 1985, bombs are dropped from helicopters out of the skies on houses in Philadelphia in an attempt to get the wanted members of the MOVE Black Militant Organization, destroying 65 homes in the process. For May 8th, 1828, U.S. Peace Society is formed. Also on May 8th, 1933, Gandhi starts a 31-day fast in jail. Also on May 8th, 1967, U.S. grand jury indicts Muhammad Ali for refusing to fight in Vietnam. Also on that date, 1970 in New York, the hard hat gangs turn on peace students protesting the war and beat them up as police watch. Also on that date, 1979, police machine gun a mass rally on the steps of San Salvador Cathedral, killing 25.
What usually happens when people without guns stand up to people with guns.
For May 9th, 1800, anti-slavery revolutionary John Brown is born. Also on May 9th, 1900, striking tram workers blow up tram cars in St. Louis. Also on May 9th, 1933, first Nazi mass book burning occurs, forgetting the quote from 1821, "When men burn books, they will burn people also in the end," unquote. Also on May 9th, 1950, Israeli troops drive 12,000 Arab villagers from southern towns in Palestine. Also on May 9th, 1969, New York Times reveals that the U.S. has been secretly bombing the neutral country of Cambodia. Nixon blows a gasket over the leak. Also on May 9th, 1970, 5 days after Kent State National Guard killing of students, over 100,000 march in Washington, D.C. in protest. On May 10th, 1857, is the beginning of the Great Mutiny as people around the world start to fight against colonial British rule. Also on May 10th, 1955, Moscow proposed joint cuts in nuclear stockpiles, U.S. hangs up the phone. Also on May 10, 1962, Robert Kennedy informs FBI Hoover that they have ordered CIA to hire underground mob connections to try to assassinate Fidel Castro. Also on that date, 1967, Army Captain Howard Levy sentenced to 3 years for refusing to train U.S. soldiers for fighting in Vietnam. That's it for this week in Radical History. Information found in the Slingshot Organizer, Google Slingshot Collective for more information. Other information discovered at the Daily Bleed website, Google the People's Calendar of the Daily Bleed for more information. Also some audio borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI New York. A reminder what anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman once said, if voting ever really changed anything, they would have made it illegal. From the Gleegly Studios, I'm yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. Omar Barghouti, co-founder and leading voice of the Palestinian Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, spoke to a full house at Harvard University following his long period of detention by the Israeli military. He was finally able to do his United States speaking tour, which was postponed due to his arrest. We feature his main address and as much of the question and answer period as time will allow. The Q&A may be difficult to follow because they took three questions at a time and then let Barghouti answer them. But we hope you will be able to follow the flow, especially as he responds to some challenging questions from the Zionist students. Here is Omar Barghouti speaking at Harvard University.
In 1923, Zionist leader Ze'ev Jabotinsky wrote, quote, "Every native population in the world resists colonists as long as it has the slightest hope of being able to rid itself of the danger of being colonized. Zionist colonization must either stop or else proceed regardless of the native population, which means that it can proceed and develop only under the protection of a power that is independent of the native population behind an iron wall which the native population cannot breach." End of quote. A key part of this iron wall that Jabotinsky spoke of is colonizing the minds of the native population, not just the lands, by searing into our consciousness, through hegemonic and sustained power, the imperative of submission to Israel's injustices as fate and the futility of hope in resisting its regime of oppression. Consequently, the long path to justice must commence with exorcising our deeply seated fears and inhibitions and embarking on a radical process of decolonizing our minds. For we cannot possibly pursue freedom while our minds remain colonized and therefore cannot even envision what freedom looks like. The decolonization of the mind, in turn, demands rekindling our well-founded hope. Hope, after all, can be contagious. This is precisely why Israel is desperately trying to suppress the boycott, divestment, and sanctions of BDS movement, a main source of hope, a key part of Palestinian popular resistance, and the most effective form of international solidarity with the nonviolent Palestinian struggle for freedom, justice, and equality. BDS, after all, has not only insisted on the rights of all Palestinians, it has also rekindled Palestinian aspirations for emancipation, justice, and peace through its effectiveness in showing a nonviolent yet realistic path to achieving them. Moreover, BDS is re-establishing the inherent relationship that the so-called Oslo peace process has all but buried between the struggle for Palestinian rights on the one hand, and on the other hand, the diverse international struggles for racial, economic, gender, social, and climate justice. Begun in 2005 by the broadest coalition in Palestinian civil society, BDS calls for ending Israel's 1967 occupation, ending its institutionalized racial discrimination system, which meets the United Nations definition of apartheid, and upholding the right of Palestinian refugees to return to the homes and lands from which they were uprooted and dispossessed in 1948 and ever since. These three basic rights correspond to the three main components of the Palestinian people: those in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, who constitute 38% of the Palestinian people, according to 2014 statistics, Palestinian citizens of present-day Israel, who constitute 12%, and Palestinians in exile, who are 50% of the Palestinian population. More than two-thirds of Palestinians are either refugees or internally displaced persons. Though launched in 2005, the movement is deeply rooted in decades of Palestinian popular, nonviolent resistance to settler colonialism and ethnic cleansing. It is inspired and strongly influenced by the South African anti-apartheid movement and the U.S. civil rights movement. Anchored in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the BDS movement has consistently and categorically opposed all forms of racism and racial discrimination, including Islamophobia and anti-Jewish racism. One's identity, we believe, should never diminish or restrict one's entitlement to rights. BDS, as a result, targets complicity, not identity. BDS is an inclusive movement that enjoys growing support among diverse communities, including a growing number of Jewish Israeli supporters, who play a significant role in exposing Israel's regime of oppression and advocating for isolating it. Despite the obvious differences between Israel's regime of oppression and that of apartheid South Africa, the similarities are striking, as many Israeli and South African analysts today recognize. Israel's regime of oppression against the Palestinian people may be a unique cocktail as it is, but it is in part a more sophisticated, evolved, and brutal form of apartheid than its South African predecessor. South Africa's Speaker of Parliament, Baleka Mbete, has recently stated, quote, "Apartheid in South Africa was a picnic compared to what we have seen in the occupied Palestinian territories," end of quote. A few weeks ago, ESQA, as was mentioned by Omar, a UN agency, concluded in a report co-authored by Professor Richard Folk, a prominent international law expert and former UN rapporteur for human rights in the occupied territories, that Israel is guilty of the crime of apartheid against the entire Palestinian people, and the same ESQA report called for BDS measures to hold Israel to account. Israeli apartheid, as some Israeli figures today admit, does not stop at the 1967 border. Earlier this year, for instance, Israeli forces destroyed most of Umm al-Hiran, a Bedouin Palestinian village in the Naqab or Negev desert, whose residents are Palestinian citizens of Israel. And they demolished it to establish a Jewish-only colony on its ruins. Israeli forces gave Palestinian families in Umm al-Hiran barely any notice to gather their furniture, photos, books, or children's toys before bulldozing their homes and livelihoods. Far from being an exception, unfortunately, Umm al-Hiran is the norm. Drunk with power and impunity, particularly since Trump's rise to power, Israel has embarked on what Palestinians fear might be an escalation of the ongoing Nakba. It has dropped its thin mask of democracy and enlightenment, moving at a dizzying speed to build as many settlements as possible in the occupied Palestinian territory. As Israel becomes more openly associated with the rising far right around the world, including xenophobic and openly anti-Semitic groups, particularly in the United States and Europe, and as it is more widely considered to be among the belligerently intolerant, faith-driven ethno-states, as Professor Tony Judd, the late Tony Judd, once put it, more people, grassroots movements, and progressive institutions will feel the moral imperative to join the BDS movement as the most effective form of solidarity with Palestinian rights, and as one of the facets of the growing global resistance to the far right. Richard Spencer, one of those leaders of the far right in this country, or alt-right, as they call them here, has even defended the white supremacist movement's racist nationalism as, quote, a sort of white Zionism. This unmistakable allusion to Israel's exclusionary foundations as a state that privileges Jewish settlers over the indigenous Palestinian population and that treats African asylum seekers as, quote, a cancer, further exposes the often obscured contradiction between Zionism and liberal ideals. As this contradiction becomes more visible, support for holding Israel to account is growing among Jewish Americans, especially millennials, as well as the broader U.S. public. A 2014 poll shows that 46% of non-Orthodox Jewish American men under 40 support a full boycott of Israel to end its occupation. Almost half. More recently, in 2016, a Brookings Institution poll shows almost half of all Americans support imposing sanctions or tougher measures against Israel to stop its illegal settlements. You don't see your politicians reflecting those polls, but one day they will. These polls and other indicators point to the impressive growth in the last few years of the Palestinian-led BDS, Movement for Palestinian Rights. We draw a lot of inspiration from the growing bonds of mutual solidarity with movements defending the rights of refugees, immigrants, women, workers, Black Americans, Muslims, Native Americans, and the LGBTQI community, and from the fact that the time-honored tactic of boycott has become the nonviolent weapon of choice for Americans opposing Trump and businesses connected to him or his daughter. Or son-in-law, or... Since hope based on illusions does not bring the oppressed any closer to justice, one must always ask whether the hope that we are nourishing is based on not just moral consistency, but also effective strategies of resistance that can take us there. In this respect, the impact of BDS must be assessed in light of its two closely related strategies, raising awareness worldwide about the UN-stipulated rights of the entire Palestinian people, and raising the material and psychological cost of Israel's regime of oppression by mobilizing individuals, institutions, civil society, and eventually states to end their practical complicity in maintaining this regime of injustice. Recent international public opinion polls, together with Israel's hysterical reaction, indicate that BDS is succeeding on both fronts. Days ago, the municipality of Barcelona in Spain announced measures to end complicity in Israel's occupation and settlements regime and defended the right to pursue Palestinian rights through BDS tactics. This follows dozens of municipalities across the Spanish state that have recently declared themselves Israeli apartheid-free zones. In September 2015, Veolia, the French corporate giant, became the first international company to end all involvement in Israeli illegal operations, following an extensive seven-year BDS campaign that cost the company tenders around the world worth over $20 billion, with a B, $20 billion. This has triggered a domino effect, with companies like Orange and CRH also pulling out of the Israeli economy in 2016. Bowing to BDS pressure after suffering what the Financial Times called reputational damage, G4S, the world's largest private security company, decided also in 2016 to end most of its involvement in Israel's illegal business, especially the incarceration business and the settlement protection and the checkpoint protection. G4S had lost contracts in Jordan, Norway, Lebanon, the European Parliament, South Africa, Colombia the country, not Columbia University, obviously. Soon Columbia University, we hope. In the first week of 2016, the $20 billion pension and health benefits fund of the United Methodist Church declared the five largest Israeli banks off limits for investment and divested from the two that it held in its portfolios. This followed the lead of the second largest Dutch pension fund, PGGM, which in 2014 divested from all Israeli banks. The Presbyterian Church USA has voted to divest from Caterpillar, Hewlett-Packard, and Motorola Solutions, as did other mainline churches in the US, because of those companies' involvement in Israel's occupation. The credit ratings agency, Moody's, has assessed that if BDS grows further, it will have a significant impact on Israel's economy. This gradually growing economic impact has come after years of BDS successes in the cultural and academic domains. Over 1,000 black activists, artists, scholars, students, and organizations in the US and elsewhere have endorsed BDS, for instance, and so did the Movement for Black Lives. Since 2015, thousands of cultural figures in Canada, Ireland, South Africa, and the UK have adopted a cultural boycott of Israel, which is institutional, targets institutions, not individuals. While many artists have cancelled gigs in Tel Aviv or refused to perform there in the first place, of the 26 Oscar nominees in 2016 who were offered expensive, extremely expensive, all paid propaganda trips by the Israeli government, none has taken. 6 out of 11 NFL players in this country, including the great Michael Bennett, have turned down a similar Israeli junket. Academic associations and tens of student governments at Stanford, UCLA, Berkeley, Northwestern, and many other US, Canadian, and UK universities have voted for various BDS measures, including divestment from companies involved in Israel's violations of human rights. But BDS cannot claim full responsibility for Israel's growing academic, cultural, and increasingly economic isolation. Israel itself takes a lot of that credit. Israel's 2015 election brought to power its most racist government ever, which has busied itself passing racist laws at an unprecedented rate through the Israeli parliament. Israeli government ministers have adopted unabashed and unmasked far-right racism, while just a few months ago, Israel's chief rabbi for the Sephardic community called for the ethnic cleansing of Gentiles, quote, from the land of Israel. Leading Israeli political and military figures have voiced huge concerns about Israel's descent into an abyss. Ehud Barak, a former prime minister, who is incidentally accused of committing many war crimes against Palestinians, yet he's a scholar here at Harvard, I hear, Ehud Barak warned that Israel has been, quote, infected by the seeds of fascism. While the current Israeli Deputy Chief of Staff, Major General Yair Golan, has compared, quote, revolting trends in Israeli society to Germany in the 1930s. Israel's lurch to the far right and beyond has inadvertently amplified support for Palestinian rights and for BDS tactics to attain them. The annual BBC Globe scan of international public opinion, for example, has in recent years shown Israel competing with North Korea in popularity, including among Europe's largest nations, by the way. Having lost many battles for the hearts and minds at the grassroots level, Israel adopted in 2014 a new top-down strategy to combat the BDS movement after its previous strategy of spending millions on propaganda alone on the so-called Brand Israel campaign has largely failed. Evoking memories of McCarthyism, the new strategy employs legal warfare, espionage, and intensified propaganda to undermine or even outlaw BDS advocacy. One desperate Israeli government minister has publicly threatened leading BDS activists with, quote, targeted civil assassination, while another established a, quote, tarnishing unit, that's the official name, tarnishing unit, to smear BDS activists and networks around the world. An Israeli anti-BDS law, recently passed, denies entry to anyone who supports or is associated with an organization that endorses BDS or merely advocates for selective boycotts targeting Israeli settlements. The Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs is working on a blacklist, quote-unquote, of Israelis who are active in any BDS or even partial boycott activities. In the US, France, and elsewhere, Israel's deeply influential lobbies are working overtime to promote suppression of free speech on Palestinian rights and to criminalize, or at the very least demonize, BDS activism. Congress is currently considering one of these draconian anti-BDS laws that arguably violate the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, as the ACLU has opined. This new anti-BDS strategy appears to be failing, as some major Israeli and Israel lobby groups today admit. In a major setback for Israel's legal war on BDS, for example, the European Union, no less, as well as the governments of Sweden, Ireland, and Netherlands, have come out in support of the right to BDS, as did Amnesty, the International Federation for Human Rights, the American Civil Liberties Union, and many, many others. But another weapon of choice wielded by Israel and its lobby groups against its critics is the anti-Semitism smear. So I'll expand a bit on this point, because I think it's very important. Israel and the Zionist movement have been aggressively trying to normalize and impose a new definition of anti-Semitism that encompasses anti-Zionism, criticism of Israel's policies or laws, and advocacy of effective measures to hold Israel accountable to international law, especially through BDS measures. Ethical principles aside, this attempted distortion of the concept of anti-Jewish racism to protect Israel from censure and accountability dehumanizes Palestinians by portraying our struggle against Israel's regime of oppression as if fueled by a visceral hatred towards Jews, not a genuine human pursuit of freedom, justice, and equality like any sane human being. This fraudulent anti-Semitism dogma presents a substantial danger to people of conscience everywhere, including those of the Jewish faith, standing in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle for rights, as it seeks to delegitimize human rights campaigning against Israel's system of injustice or even its specific policies. Conflating opposition to the State of Israel with anti-Semitism is also perilous to Jewish communities the world over, as it dilutes the notion of anti-Jewish racism beyond recognition and arguably nourishes real anti-Jewish bigotry by indirectly implicating all Jewish communities and Jewish persons at large in Israel's egregious crimes against the Palestinians and others. Zionism, after all, has always thrived on real anti-Semitism, including during the rise of the Nazi anti-Jewish legislation in Germany in the 1930s, viewed by the Zionist movement at the time as a victory against the worst enemy of Zionism, assimilation. To end this part, there is nothing Jewish about Israel's system of oppression. Since there's nothing Jewish about Israel's occupation or apartheid, there's nothing inherently anti-Jewish in opposing Israel's occupation and apartheid. To conclude, the great Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish once wrote that he wished he could be liberated of Palestine so he could write poems of love, life, and mundane topics. But so long as Palestinian liberation itself remained elusive, Darwish wrote, he had no choice but to write about Palestine. Inspired by Darwish, I have a deep desire myself to end my BDS activism, indeed, to see the BDS movement itself come to an end. For this to happen, though, we need to attain our freedom, justice, and equality first. When, not if, this happens, I'll be exhilarated to redirect my deep passion for human rights to other struggles that I'm particularly passionate about, especially the struggle by blacks for racial and economic justice and the struggle of indigenous communities around the world for reparations. When, not if, we attain our comprehensive rights, I'll be delighted to fulfill my other passions in life, especially philosophy and choreography. But until then, I have no choice but to continue my modest contribution to this most noble struggle for a life that is worth living, as Darwish puts it, and that can only be a life under freedom, justice, and equality. Thank you.
And I get to ask the first question, and would like to ask a question that I think I came with, and maybe it's already been answered, but I think I might be one of those people who is very familiar with BDS, but has a little bit of apprehension about the academic and cultural boycott. It feels as if one is somehow destroying some of the fabric of academia to be boycotting other academics and the cultural issues that bring Israel and its critics often together. So I'd like to ask a little more about that, what that means exactly. And perhaps to be slightly more specific, you mentioned these trips to Israel that have been offered to Oscar nominees and others, but that also is true in the university setting, and certainly here at Harvard College, where there are many students who are sort of of Jewish origin. You have some Jewish part of their heritage, but have never been to Israel. And they are sponsored for trips to Israel. More recently, however, that's been expanded. And there are Muslim students and students from the interfaith world here at Harvard from other backgrounds who would like to go to Israel and who are sponsored, whether by Hillel or some outside organization, again, on an all-expenses trip to Israel. And so how do you think about those sorts of things? So that, I mean, these are presumably educational. I always ask if they go anywhere on the West Bank. They may sometimes do go to Palestine, sometimes not very long. So I think for those of us in the university, the issue of what an academic and cultural boycott really means would be very important for us.
Thank you. Actually, thanks for the question. It's very pertinent because there's a lot of misunderstanding about Palestinian-led academic and cultural boycott. Those who are old enough in this room, there aren't many, but some, who might have been involved in the South African anti-apartheid movement, as I was when I went to school at Columbia, would remember that the boycott, academic and cultural boycott against South African apartheid, was a blanket boycott that targeted every single academic, artist, as well as institution in South Africa. Everyone was off limits for us then. The Palestinian academic and cultural boycott, though, is institutional only. We do not target Israeli individuals because we do not target identity. We target complicity. All Israeli institutions, academic and cultural, are involved in Israel's violations of human rights to varying degrees. All of them. That's why we target them. We do not target individuals. So if, let's say, Harvard has an exchange program with Tel Aviv University, we target that. We're trying to cut links of complicity between academics and institutions outside with Israeli institutions, but not with Israeli academics. Continuing relations with Israeli academics, they publish, they tour the world, they participate in conferences, they teach, they do everything that academics do. There's nothing in BDS that infringes on their academic freedom in any way. And those debates happen at the American Anthropological Association and the Modern Language Association, American Studies, National Women's Association, and many, many, many associations where BDS was passed or debated. And the other side came out really not having a very coherent argument about trying to say that BDS infringes in any way on academic freedom, because it doesn't. On the second point about student trips that are funded by Israel, propaganda trips, basically. Israel took a page out of South Africa's apartheid regime's propaganda. South Africa used to do the exact same thing. Sponsored trips by artists and students and trade union leaders and so on. Come see South Africa, the only developed economy in God-forsaken Africa, and so on and so forth. We have better gay rights and better women's rights and better for white, obviously, but regardless, I mean, that's a minor detail. Israel, in the same thing, sponsors, spends tens and tens of millions of dollars on free trips to just about anyone who's interested. Third-rate Hollywood figures, retired artists who want to come back to the stage, just about anyone is welcome, and they're paid very handsomely, to try to project an image of Israel as if it's a liberal, dynamic society to cover up its minor problem of occupation, apartheid, and settler colonialism. So it's really a form of whitewashing, pinkwashing, greenwashing, all kinds of washing. One thing that all this washing has in common, there's a lot of dirt to wash.
Hi, my name is Hazani Kodamadar. I'm a proud daughter of a Palestinian refugee convicted in 1948. My question to you is, we are at Harvard University, one of the most prominent supposedly policy schools in the country and arguably the world, yet we have a narrative on our campus that this is an anti-Israeli campus, an anti- a Jewish campus, and anybody who engages in advocacy around this part gets kind of told accordingly. I wonder what we can do as students to better mobilize our voices to the mainstream powers that be and lobbies that be, and how we get to a place where being Palestinian and actually having an identity on campus isn't perceived to be a crime and treated accordingly.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Willie. How are you doing? I was wondering, well, when you think about the framework about this issue, how important you put the role of political Zionism in terms of settler colonialism in Palestine. And considering those two points, Zionism and settler colonialism, what impact and implications do you think that has on how a solution could be reached and what obviously points should
And the question on Palestinian identity at Harvard, I went to school at Columbia, so we have it very easy here. I mean, seriously. it was a jungle out there. So to talk about Palestinian identity, I was joking with a number of activists before this, that we couldn't in the 80s at Columbia call for ending the occupation. It was considered an extremely, extremely off-the-wall radical statement. Peace in the Middle East was as radical as was tolerated. We did, of course, call for ending the occupation, but we were treated as extremists. But it's very important what you say about Palestinian identity and how immediately, once your voice, your Palestinian voice comes out, you're immediately labeled, you're immediately sneered. There was a point when those Ivy League schools smeared Jewish voices as well, when they banned Jewish students as well. Mm-hmm. So they have a history of racism against Jews and against blacks and against women, you name it. The discrimination is in the history of these Ivy League
schools. It's about time we assert our Palestinian voices and we make sure that they listen to us. And if they don't, we mobilize and mobilize and grow our power until they have to listen to us.
Professor Barghouti, before I begin, I just want to state that it's historically inaccurate.
Mr.
Barghouti, I just want to state that it's historically inaccurate to make the claim that the Jews ever had equal rights in the East. I think that if you read Martin Gilbert, a foremost Jewish scholar on Jewish history, he made it very clear that Jews were actually routinely reminded of their second-class status across the Arab world, whether it was in Egypt or across the Muslim world, including Iran. Now, my question goes as follows. In March, you were arrested in Israel on a massive tax fraud case involving around $700,000 of hidden income. Despite this, Israel allowed you to come to the United States on this tour.
So gracious.
That in the U.S. and the U.K., for instance, someone who's accused of such crimes would be permitted just to travel freely. Would an apartheid state allow one of its harshest critics, recently involved in massive tax fraud, to go out of the country and engage in propaganda against them?
Hi, I'm Leila. For 38 years, I've done public speaking, organizing for Palestine. The last one was in 2002, the Somerville Divestment Project, in which we put ballots on the election, and they were very successful. Maybe we didn't get 50%, but I consider it 45% success, because we reached large numbers of people, we heard the voters' opinions, we talked to people on the streets. Recently, I went to a conference in Detroit where my daughter spoke at an academic conference. And in the middle of the night, in our hotel, Homeland Security showed up and scared us half to death, along with all the other people who went to the conference. I think the problem in this country, I'm not going to talk long, is that there is a system of oppression within the country. And how do we face, in the United States, this system of oppression that stands up with Israel, right or wrong? When I talk about the people, the grassroots we could reach and the universities we could reach, I'm talking about a system of oppression which is oppressing blacks, oppressing natives. And I just heard about something where they had a law like Contel Pro against Arab Americans in the 70s. I never heard about it before. So how do we approach these things and fix? Because Palestine, unfortunately, is oppressed through the United States.
Thank you so much for your presentation. My name is Ari, and I'm both Mexican and Jewish. And I have a question about, I wonder what is your position or the BDS movement position regarding G4S? If they move out of Israel, I think that's a great thing. But unfortunately, they continue to profit with building walls, detention centers, arresting and dispossessing migrants who are trying to cross the border to a land that perhaps they have ancestral rights that many of us don't. So what is the position of the BDS movement regarding G4S, even though they pull out of Palestine, of Israel, but still profiting for the same things? Thank you.
Although the first question came right out of the Israeli Foreign Ministry talking points, I will assume that it was an honest student question, and I will answer it accordingly. I am under a gag order, as you very well know, so I cannot speak at all in any detail about the latest phase of repression against me. I'm not allowed legally to speak. So you're asking me a question knowing well that I cannot answer it. As I wrote, after 12 days of interrogation, that I am not allowed by law to speak about this issue, but I would like to put this in context. I mentioned in my talk, I don't know if you were here, that Israel last year established a tarnishing unit. The Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel, which leads, coordinates the Israeli government's fight against BDS and spends tens of millions of dollars in fighting BDS, last year established a tarnishing unit. That's what they called it. It's not my name. And the tarnishing unit, you can guess what its purpose is, but openly, is aimed at tarnishing the reputation of activists in the BDS movement. The point is to dig up any dirt they can find, and if they cannot find it, they fabricate it. So I'll stop at that. Could an apartheid state
allow someone like you to leave, or gracious. What does this have to do with the definition of apartheid? Many blind supporters of Israel, unfortunately, sometimes redefine apartheid according to their liking, their opinion. Your opinion, my opinion, do not matter. Apartheid is a crime against humanity defined in the UN Convention for the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid since 1973. It doesn't matter if Israel has a judge who's Palestinian or a dancer who's Palestinian or allows Omar Barghouti to leave or not to leave. This is completely irrelevant. We are in an academic institution. Let's at least try to stick to some notions that are accepted in international law. Apartheid is a well-defined crime. It's the systematic, legalized racial oppression by one racial group against another, which Israel clearly is. Israel has more than 60 laws that discriminate against its, quote, non-Jewish population simply because they're non-Jewish. 60 laws, not just policies. That is apartheid. Leila's question on what do we do about the U.S. system of oppression, that requires like 3 hours. But I'm sure many of you in this room know much more than I how to face this system of oppression. But I think Leila has touched on a very important part of that, which is the intersectionality of struggles. For too long, many communities were trying to fight the system alone. And guess what? We have not done a very good job. The system is very well united. It targets all of us. The oppressions are working very much in unison. It's high time we start, too, to work in unison. And not in a transactional, opportunistic way of you scrub my back and I scrub yours, but in a real organic, principled alliance of justice struggles that connect the struggle by blacks for justice, by women, LGBTQI, by Latinos, and so on and so forth, the indigenous population of this land, together against the system. Because the system, more than ever, is not just a far-right system, a xenophobic system, a racist system. It's a corporate system. It's a military, a security industrial complex system. It's so blunt now with the Trump administration, I think he's making life easier for us because the target is much easier to see. We will suffer a lot under Trump, all of us, the whole world, as well as communities of color in this country, many marginalized communities in this country. But one thing is clearer, the enemy is clearer than ever. It's about time we unite. This question on G4S, thank you so much for this question. In fact, in my meeting with student activists and community activists before this, we discussed this very issue. Veolia, I mentioned Veolia, the French conglomerate that was forced to quit the Israeli market after losing more than $20 billion worth of contracts around the world. When we won that battle, after 7 years of a BDS campaign, in our statement, we said, we shall continue to support any campaign around the world that targets Veolia because of its involvement in violating people's rights in the water privatization, in all kinds of transport privatization, and many other campaigns. And I think anti-Veolia activists in the Palestine Solidarity campaign, in Boston in particular, are playing a very important role in connecting our struggle against Veolia with others. I think Nancy Murray is here, I saw her somewhere, and others that I recognize are very much involved in this intersectional struggle. Similarly with G4S, yes, we forced G4S after a 4-year BDS campaign to quit most of its illegal business in Israel. It's still involved in a police training project that we're pursuing it until it stops. But even if we get, and when, not if, sorry, when we get G4S out, we will continue to support campaigns in the United States, in the UK, in South Africa, in India, anywhere, against G4S because of its involvement in violating human rights in those countries and elsewhere. That's a commitment of principle that we will continue to honor.
So these will be the last questions that we take because we're ending at 9. So people are already here.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Horowitz. I'm a sophomore at the college, and my question is as follows.
Can I just speak up, please?
Sure. My question is as follows. If BDS aims to bring full human rights to the Palestinian people, then why does your movement not boycott the government of Hamas in Gaza, which Amnesty International condemned for torturing Palestinian civilians and uses humanitarian aid money to buy weapons instead of food for its starving population.
Hi, Alex from Stockholm College as well. My question is specifically a pragmatic one of advocacy. As an advocate myself and having worked a bit around this whole thing, as an Israeli, one of the things that frustrated me was the lack of conversation and dialogue and empathy on either side. And this is something that I still find, I think, on both sides of the aisle. BDS, to me, seems like it calls for moving away from the negotiation table, for a boycott as opposed to a conversation. And I'm wondering very pragmatically, whether on college campuses or in these dialogues across the country, where you think this polarization leads, and how you see coexistence after the conversation, or the lack of conversations that were happening.
My name is Hannah. I am the proud daughter of a Jewish refugee from Nazi Germany in 1938. And in November of last year, when Donald Trump got elected, I finally did what I didn't do in 1981 when Ronald Reagan became president, and I didn't do when George W. Bush became president. I actually activated my application for German citizenship to be repatriated to Germany because this does not feel like a safe place. And 80 years after my father was evicted, I have the right to go to Germany. My father is long dead. I'm wondering in that context if you could address the Palestinian right of return under international law as a matter of international moral shared community.
Hi, my name is Ade. I'm from Palestine, that's it. And speaking out of experience, I know hundreds of families in Gaza who are like now living under the line of poverty because their parents are like no longer allowed to work in Israel. So my question is, if like BDS does great work and like close small businesses, like big businesses in Israel, where like people from the West Bank work, and like you know that the labor market in Palestine is not the best. So what's some alternative solutions for those who will lose their work in Israel/Palestine.
Jennifer's question, again, I'll try to convince myself it's not texted by the Minister of Strategic Affairs. I'll assume it's an honest-to-goodness question. A movement seeking full Palestinian human rights, why doesn't it call for boycotting Hamas? Because of its proven violations of human rights and civil rights in Gaza. Now, BDS, as I said earlier, before your question, well before your question, has a very narrow mandate as a human rights movement. We seek specifically isolating Israel's regime of oppression, corporations and institutions that are involved in maintaining this oppression, until we achieve an end to the occupation, end to apartheid, and the right of return for refugees. It's as simple as that. We do not venture beyond this mandate. Simply, we cannot agree on anything beyond this mandate in this massive coalition that makes up the BDS movement in Palestine. Do we all agree on a social agenda? Not necessarily. Do we all agree with this political ideology or that? Certainly not. But all of us are involved in other struggles as well. It's not like we do BDS and nothing else. Some of us are feminists and work in the women's movement. Some of us work in labor movements. Some of us in the BDS movement in Palestine are gay and lesbian activists, and so on and so forth. They don't do all of this in the BDS movement necessarily. All of us have multiple paths. We continue our struggles for civil rights, for human rights, including against Palestinian repression. So under occupation, under the system of occupation, apartheid and settler colonialism, the system of oppression is the main problem. Israel's system of colonization is the biggest problem we face, obviously. But that doesn't mean we don't have problems on our own, including denying women's equal rights, including so many other rights are being denied. And of course, as consistent human rights activists, we have to address those, but not necessarily within the BDS movement. We have other movements, you know. It's not like we are monolithic in Palestinian society. As a dance choreographer, I've always argued against repression of the arts, of freedom of expression and culture, and so on and so forth, but I have no time to go into that. On the question of dialogue, again, and polarization. Let me address polarization first, and then I'll come back to dialogue. I swear, I'll talk about all of it. polarization. Those who come to a campus and do not want polarization should better stay home. And if you go to any academic institution, respectable or not, you expect debate. You expect people to have controversy. I personally, in my philosophical studies, view controversy as an essential tool for progress. Essential. If you don't want controversy, stay home. You listen to the people that you like, and you don't have to be exposed to corrupting ideas from the other side of the aisle. So polarization is part of life. Live with it.
Right.
And you know what? Injustice has a tendency of polarizing people. It's not resistance. You know, masters and slaves are usually polarized. It's not the slave's resistance that's making this polarize. It's the relationship of oppression that polarizes more than anything else.
All right.
That's right.
Now, going back to the dialogue issue. It sounds fine, but let's really try to unpack that. Masters and slaves never dialogue. Even if they appear as if they're having a dialogue, it's always coercive. I'll give you an anecdote. I was in Rotterdam, the Netherlands, and after a talk with someone from Bethlehem and an Israeli, Palestinian, and Dutch speakers, some elected official, Dutch elected official, stood up and said, instead of boycotts, we should love each other. I resisted the tendency to want to puke. And I told him, look, if I see a master and a slave hugging, it is not love, it is rape. It is rape. It is coercive. Even if they appear kissing and loving, it's never love. You cannot have a serious coexistence, let alone love, in the presence of colonial oppression. So, going to dialogue, yes for dialogue, 100%, but ethical dialogue, where you and I believe that we have equal rights as humans, we deserve equal rights. Where you do not view me as a relative human who deserves a relative, a subset of rights because I'm not a full human. That cannot be a dialogue if it's not based on that basic, profound equality that you view me as an equal human. If you do not view me as an equal human who deserves equal rights to everyone else around this world, I have no interest in having any dialogue with you. Hannah's question, or comment rather, what can I say? Thank you so much. I think it's a brilliant comment from the heart, and I really empathize with that. I know a number of Holocaust survivors, sons and daughters of Holocaust survivors, who made a very similar comment. In fact, some of them, Jewish descendants of Holocaust survivors, have a whole group defending the Palestinian right of return. And I think it's such a noble gesture for such Holocaust survivors to say, just as we said never again to us, we should say never again to anyone. So rights are rights, and we as human rights activists have to be evident. And the last question from Oday about Gaza laborers. Gaza being under siege for 10 years now, under a horrible siege where Israel is counting calories, average calories entering Gaza to keep people on the verge of starvation, yet not starving yet because it wouldn't look nice on CNN. And this is according to official reports published by CNN, BBC, and others. Under this horrific condition of dehumanization, inhumane conditions where Palestinians, almost 2 million Palestinians in Gaza live, of course, we do not call on Gaza workers, the tiny minority who might get permits to work in Israeli projects, that they cannot. BDS does not call for that. We understand that under occupation, that the colonized must deal with coercive relationships. We do not expect Palestinians living under apartheid or occupation to observe the same guidelines of BDS as everyone else who has a choice. Because we're not some romantic activists who seek an ideal situation that's divorced from reality. We understand the reality, and being ethical is being in touch with reality. We understand coercive relationships. A Palestinian in Gaza has no choice but to consume many Israeli products because nothing else is there. And if he or she has any chance, one in a thousand chance, to get a permit to work in an Israeli project. Of course, we do not object to that. What we object to are the political leaders, Palestinians, that are, of course, occupation first and foremost, but also the Palestinian Authority, for example, that is investing so much in so-called security coordination rather than in infrastructure, in jobs, in farming and agriculture and so on, creating jobs. So there's a lot of blame, internal blame, on the Palestinian side. But certainly BDS does not call for people to cut their livelihoods. We understand that under oppression, we must deal with the system.
You have been listening to Omar Barghouti, co-founder of the Palestinian BDS movement, speaking at Harvard University.
Also, a German soldier is arrested for acts preparing a terror attack at Vienna airport. His plan was to blame his attack on Syrian refugees. How would he get away with that? And why, more to the point, has this hardly been reported in the UK? Why do our press spike the story if a terrorist is a white non-Muslim? Also, close ties between Israel and ISIS revealed as ISIS apologised for accidentally attacking an Israeli army patrol. And why did the Gestapo pick on the Freemasons? There's a new TV series at the moment on Sky One on every Monday evening, and we get a review of that inside the Freemasons. That's one of the questions they never asked on that programme from an ex-Freemason. Also, sticking with the Nazis, Hitler's deputy Rudolf Hess flew alone to Scotland in 1941 on a secret peace mission just before the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union. But why did he spend the rest of his life alone in Berlin's Spandau prison with no outside contact allowed? What did Hess know? And a UBS whistleblower this week, Christoph Miley, with more evidence that his bank were funding ISIS and Al-Qaeda through numbered accounts, just like the 1930s when they funded the Nazis' rise to power and rearmament. Swiss banksters make lots of money from war, then they steal the money from the victims. Our sister show Dialect is here at BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, former Mason Ian Matteson tells us what's been missing so far from this current Monday night Sky One series Inside the Freemasons, a special on that next week. He wonders whether it's been commissioned and produced for Rupert Murdoch by the Masons themselves. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect, or if you can't wait, you can download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But first, Martin, you flagged this up to me during the meet. You emailed me about it. ISIS apologising for attacking an Israeli patrol.
Well, if you'll see, the article's from the Jerusalem Post, and an Israeli minister says that they'd had a clash with ISIS inside Syria, but that ISIS had apologised and they're all back being chums again. Although, of course, ISIS are supposedly our bitterest enemies, and supposedly the bitterest enemies of the State of Israel, but apparently not.
But no, they're not, are they? Because ISIS themselves say that they would prefer to get rid of all of the Muslims that don't agree with them before they'll take on any Jews.
Well, the suspicion by the Syrian general staff, the Iranian general staff and the Russian general staff is that ISIS is in fact run by the Saudis, the Turks, the Israelis, the British, the Qataris and the French and the Americans. And, of course, they're right. What at the same time as we pretend to be opposing them.
What about the Kuwaitis?
Oh, well, they're involved as well. Yes. But, I mean, the point is that ISIS is presented as this boogeyman thing that we've got to be opposed to. And all the evidence, I mean, the Israelis have been flying close air support for ISIS. The RAF flew close air support for ISIS at the Des Azor attack, where an RAF drone flown from RAF Waddington helped to kill over 60 Syrian soldiers. And ISIS coordinated their attack with that air assault. The same thing happened with the the Tomahawk tweet on the Syrian airbase. ISIS took advantage to attack the airbase whilst NATO obligingly provided the air cover. And I think the Syrian army and the Russian army are pretty clear that we are the air force for ISIS.
Before we get on to this Nazi stuff, this research this week, let's have a bit of a fly around the world first. South Korea, these missiles have actually been deployed this week by the United States, as well as their carriers chugging towards the peninsula.
Yeah, well, there's a general presidential election going on in South Korea, and the leader, whose name I can't remember, but
well, actually, no, the president is in jail. It's a woman.
That's right. It was a conservative president enforced out through because of corruption. So they're having a presidential election, and the front runner in that presidential election is of liberal disposition. And they basically are saying, well, we don't want a confrontation with North Korea. We'd rather just negotiate with North Korea. We certainly don't want this high-level missile battery to be deployed. And, of course, Trump was saying at one stage it costs us $1 billion to employ this. You've got to pay for it. They're saying, well, we're not paying for it for two reasons. We're not paying for it. And secondly, we don't want it. It shouldn't be there. The Chinese don't want it there either, because this doesn't do anything to protect South Korea's security. It's a way of threatening the Chinese. And, of course, they don't like it. And they've started sanctions against South Korea on the basis that they've got to get
okay,
rid of this
look,
system.
Call me cynical, but do the American Pentagon really care any more about South Korean lives than North Korean lives?
No, they don't. And, of course, the South Koreans are going to get a chance to vote in their election and say, well, actually, we don't want this war policy. And, of course, that could be very good, because the Americans will then be, all dressed up with nowhere to go.
Well, there's been several protests also in South Korea, as well as in Okinawa.
Where they've tried to deploy it, the locals have all tried to blockade it and prevent it from being deployed. You've got to remember that South Korea's got a very checkered history. The various military strongmen who've run South Korea over the years, backed by the West, have been pretty brutal. They killed, during the 1950s, before the Korean War broke out, the South Korean dictator, backed by the West, killed hundreds of thousands of suspected communists. And, of course, during the Korean War itself, 20% of the North Korean population was killed by Allied bombing. 20%. And, of course, they remember this.
Well, if you've not watched it already...
We've forgotten about it, but they haven't.
We have a link on a show page from a couple of weeks ago to John Pilger's excellent most recent documentary, The Australian Filmmaker. He was making stuff for World in Action, wasn't he? Back in the 1970s, I seem to remember. Still going strong. Brilliant filmmaker. So I'll put a link to that again on this week's show page. The Coming War on China is the name of that film. But we're not finished with North Korea yet, Martin, because the Pentagon is seeking to link Iran and North Korea, saying that they've got similar-looking missiles.
Ooh, what? They're pointy. Pointy missiles. Mm. And, of course, the other thing they were saying is that the Syrians who supposedly carried out the chemical weapons attack, although all the evidence suggests that they didn't, just like the previous one, they apparently, Fox News was saying, well, they get their chemical weapons from North Korea. And as we know, these regimes are all in cahoots to frustrate the march of freedom.
I mean, it's difficult for the journalists, isn't it? Because they're thinking, well, we've just got to report what they say rather than question it. And it's difficult to question what these...
Well, it's not just that. They actually go out... I mean, you don't become a New York Times journalist by questioning the party line, and if you do, you soon get removed. Seymour Hersh has written in the London Review of Books, the New York Review of Books wouldn't publish it, The Red Lines and the Rat Lines, which pretty conclusively showed that the chemical weapons attack a couple of years ago was definitely carried out by the rebels with sarin from Libya, helped by NATO.
Well, you're talking about Libya. America has just been boosting its presence in Libya. It's a new big American base in the south of Libya.
Yes, and the Russians are also talking to various factions about their people coming in there, and the Egyptians are intervening, and of course there's nobody controlling that coastline, and as it comes to summer now, we're going to get thousands and thousands of people coming across the Mediterranean trying to get into the European Union because there's nobody to control the coastline anymore, because we got rid of the existing government and we've replaced it with a chaotic mess, which is pretty much what we've done in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan and various other
places.
Great
that you mentioned Afghanistan. I was just going to mention that as well. Pentagon is pitching an Afghan war plan to Trump next week. It's talking about a whole new surge, loads more troops going back to Afghanistan.
Well, do you remember when we...
The British are going to go too, apparently.
Oh, yes. Oh, well, don't forget Helmand province is now firmly under the control of the Taliban.
It's only, I think, a third of the country is now controlled by the Afghan government.
Yes. Well, don't forget, when we opposed the Afghan war originally, various people said, oh, no, we've got to do something about Al-Qaeda or whatever, although there was no evidence that that Al-Qaeda were necessarily directly involved in the 9/11 attacks, apart from the claims made by the West. And we were told that those who opposed the war in Afghanistan, that it would all be over very quickly, and when they seized Kabul and the Northern Alliance took power, the previous allied Dostan, previously allied with the Russians, took power, we were told that was all over, and the pacifists were all wrong, and in actual fact, you know, the war was over really quickly and it was a much better setup. Now, where are we now, decades later, talking about sending soldiers back to Afghanistan? And you know what? We can carry on sending our soldiers to Afghanistan forever. We will never beat the Afghans. The Taliban are already in negotiations with the government, because they've got to be. The government's got to be in negotiations with them. When Trump dropped his mother of all bombs the other week, apparently the military did that without telling him, but then he claimed credit. Hamid Karzai, who used to be their puppet, said this is intolerable. You're just using this as an experimental place to use your weapons. You've got to ask yourself the question, well, what is this? Is it a democratic government in Afghanistan that we're defending? No, it's a narco state.
And is it a democratic government in the United States that's doing these actions?
Well, indeed. Trump didn't win the most votes in the election. Under the American system, that still makes him
but
the
it's
president.
The system. It's the system.
Yeah, well,
I mean,
the
it's
system.
It's like here, you know, you could quite easily, if you lose in lots of constituencies, you could quite easily become a winning party without winning the majority of votes.
Yeah, but you could say, well, that's our system. But the communists in China say, that's our system.
Yeah.
They say, we win every election. We do have elections, but our system is you've got to be in the communist party.
I agree with you. I think it would be sensible to move to something a little bit more mature, like PR here in Britain. But anyway, we're not there, and they're not in America. So breaking. Also, another story relating back to Syria, we talked about in Israel earlier with ISIS. The Israeli Air Force has been bombing, hasn't it? Quite a lot out down in Damascus and places like that. As the Israelis then also, they say, well, this is consistent with our policy, but they neither confirm nor deny they're even doing it. So is this just an undeclared war?
It is, yes. Effectively, we are supporting Al-Qaeda. The Israelis are supporting Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And we're now back on the programme of getting rid of Assad, even though he won the democratic election that he held in Syria a few years ago. Now, people say it's not really democratic, whatever. It was good enough. It's good enough to keep his army fighting, even though they've taken tens of thousands of casualties and they're still fighting, because they know that victory is the only option for them. They cannot possibly allow the country to be overrun by foreign jihadis supported by Saudi Arabia and NATO. It's not going to happen. They're not going to crumble. And if Britain and Theresa May wants to go to war with Syria, we will be in the wrong and they will win. And unfortunately, there'll have to be British casualties, because that's the only way language that people understand.
I mean, Syria is likely to be won or lost in the air. We're hearing that from midnight tonight, Syrian safe zones will be closed by Russia to all US coalition planes. De-escalation zones in Syria are going to be closed for warplanes of US-led international coalition, says the Russian envoy. Safe zones that regional powers have agreed to create in Syria will be closed to all military planes of the international US-led coalition, Russia's envoy to Syria talks said. Turkey and Iran agreed on Thursday to Russia's proposal for de-escalation zones, a move welcomed by the UN but met with scepticism from the US and from Syrian rebel groups. So you're right, they do seem to be aligned on this anyway. Speaking from the Syrian summit in the Kazakh capital Astana on Thursday, Russian envoy Alexander Lavrentyev said that Syrian government fighter jets are also not expected to fly over the de-escalation zones for 6 months. So what will happen if the Americans do decide they want to fly over these zones
from
midnight?
Well, I understand that Trump and Putin have had a telephone conversation about this. So it may be that the policy is aligned. But it may not be. I mean, it's a very dangerous situation, because a miscalculation by anybody... the Turks have signed up to this agreement, and of course some of the rebels aren't happy with this. This kind of trying to find an agreement is what we should have been doing all along, instead of pushing the idea Assad must go, Assad must go, Assad must go. He's always said he's prepared to stand in an election. And they're saying, but we don't want you to stand in an election. You're a butcher. Well, so's President Sisi in Egypt. He's a butcher. Donald Trump, he's a butcher. As he rightly said, what makes us so innocent? He's quite right. Since 9/11, the US has been responsible for millions of civilian deaths.
And what about since World War II?
Well, we're talking since World War II, and particularly in the 1980s, when they were supporting the Contra rebels in Nicaragua, who killed 30,000 civilians, RENAMO in Mozambique, which killed another million or so, UNITA in Angola. They devastated these countries, absolutely devastated them.
Yeah, but they're our greatest ally.
Who's our greatest ally?
The United States.
Well, indeed. And, of course, once we leave the European Union, as we're going to, then the Americans will tell us what to do and we will just do it. It'll be yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, sir.
Don't you think
it?
That there's any, to any extent, Britain is a moderating influence on the US or
no,
not?
Not at all. In actual fact, it seems to me that the sort of the city of London, the British establishment and military industrial complex, they are definitely part of the problem, not part of the solution. When Trump was talking more pacifically towards the Russians, for example, Boris Johnson stomped in and tried to stir things up further. And that's because we are, you know, the City of London and Wall Street are pretty much the axis of evil, really.
It's like the Buddington Club and the Skull and Bones running the whole of the Western world, effectively, although I think quite a lot of Europeans don't like it like that.
No, well, I mean, as you know, Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister under Mitterrand, not under Sarkozy, he was interviewed on the TV in France some years ago, and he said, before the Arab Spring, I was approached by British officials who said to me, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate?
Well, that was whilst David Miliband was Foreign Secretary.
Well, indeed, and that just means that New Labour...
I don't know if any of the BBC people have put that question to him yet.
Well, I mean, it's quite obvious that the vast majority of mainstream British politicians are absolutely unaware that we started the war in Syria. And I don't suppose we did it on our own. We'll have done it on behalf of the
I mean, David Miliband
Americans.
Was also supervising torture whilst he was Foreign Secretary.
Indeed he was.
Well, not directly, but he was certainly signing
yes,
it off.
And, yeah.
I mean, just explain how this works, because, I mean, people like Foreign Secretaries, Prime Ministers, etc., will they not just sign off some of these things like special operations using special forces?
No, there's
and
an
then
awful-
if everything goes wrong, then the intelligence services will deny that the Prime Minister has actually signed these things.
Well, the fact of the matter is that they basically kept in the dark. It's not as if they wouldn't go along with it. They probably would go along with it, but it's easier if they're not told anything. All this stuff happens. I mean, the funding for the White Helmets via James Lemessurier, the former British intelligence officer based in Turkey. I saw David Miliband was tweeting the pictures of the poor child that was covered in dust that had been rescued by the White Helmets. Wasn't it terrible? The Swedish Doctors for Human Rights have brought out a report suggesting that the White Helmets not only are not a humanitarian organisation, but they're actually actively involved in killing children whilst they're pretending to save them so that they can blame the government. And that's all paid for by the US and British taxpayer, the British taxpayer in particular.
I agree.
We pay for this.
Always follow the money. And the British London media are simply not doing this at all. One of the fascinating interviews I've read over the last week from the Foundation for Defence of Democracies in the US, article written by David Andrew Weinberg, terror financiers are operating openly in Qatar and Kuwait. A White House readout following President Trump's phone conversation Thursday with the Emir of Qatar. So the two leaders discussed stopping terror finance throughout the region. Washington has good reason to raise the issue. Just last week, Obama administration's Assistant Treasury Secretary for Terrorist Financing, that is actually, since Trump took over, and his name is Daniel Glazer, revealed that designated terrorist financiers continue to operate openly in Qatar and its Gulf neighbour Kuwait.
Yeah. I mean, why is anybody surprised? I mean, we've been in alliance with these places for years.
Why is nothing done about this? I mean, we're supposedly fighting these terror groups.
Yeah, but that's only supposedly.
And yet we know that they're getting their money from these countries. We're doing absolutely nothing about it. Not only that, we won't even mention it.
No, that's right.
It's taboo.
We're basically being fed a diet of lies, propaganda and war criminality. And can I just stress that if people don't believe any of the things we're saying, then go to our show page, thisweek.org.
.uk.
.uk, and that we will put the link so that you can do your own research. I mean, there's no real excuse in the modern era for being ignorant about this. The whole world, the dogs in the street in the Middle East know that NATO supports jihadi terrorists. Our closest allies are Saudi Arabia, who've invaded Yemen and Bahrain. And, of course, in Bristol, people working up at Filton earn a good living supplying the Saudis, who are the biggest supporters of terrorism on the planet, with weaponry. And that's how we make our living. And they are our allies. And they are also the terrorists.
In the meantime, former Premier Hoss has joined the Palestinian hunger strike. He's the former Premier of Lebanon. This is a Palestinian hunger strike which has been going on now by political prisoners, not dissimilar to the Northern Ireland hunger strike, for 2 weeks now. Virtually no reporting whatever in the London media or much of the Western media.
Well, what happens is that things which are not considered to be important...
I mean, the former Prime Minister is joining the hunger strike.
Well, he's in Lebanon, yes.
Yeah.
Well, he's joining it in solidarity, presumably.
But this isn't being reported at all.
No, it'll be reported in the area. The Palestinian press will be reporting it to their people. We've got far too many other things to think about. What about Brexit? We haven't got time for hunger strikes in Palestine. We've got to talk about Brexit, 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 Brexit. More Brexit, more Brexit, Brexit. Are you against Brexit? You for Brexit?
So look, just look.
Hunger strike,
but let's just
that.
Look at this. Why is it that something so important as a 2 week long so far and carrying on, hundreds of political prisoners on hunger strike, many of whom have been interred without trial? Well, we're not interested.
Well, we are on this show, and the fact is that, of course, I don't know how far they're going to push it. I mean, in Turkey, there have been hunger strikes in the prisons where, you know, scores of people have died, and even that hasn't managed to change anything. So we'll have to see. But, I mean, we're moving towards a general war in the Middle East. That's where we're going. And Theresa May's strong and stable government will make sure that we get involved. And, of course, there will be consequences for that.
OK, well, talking about a general war, that sort of thing, I mean, no, we're not saying, I don't think, on this programme, it's going to happen. What we're saying is, it's certainly, the indications are there, and we need to be just sensibly ready if something like that does happen. And one of the, we had the hustings last week, so we haven't had done this for the last week. We were actually effectively, I suppose, doing 2 weeks tonight of this international stuff. But one of the things that was about 2 weeks ago that this happened was the discussion about Jeremy Corbyn's foreign policy. And then afterwards, Michael Fallon saying that he would be prepared to do a nuclear first strike. So let's have a little listen. That was on the Nick Ferrari show on LBC, following Jeremy Corbyn's appearance on the Mars show on the BBC. So let's have a listen to that clip with Michael Fallon, the Defence Secretary, talking about Jeremy Corbyn with Nick Ferrari on LBC now.
I mean, it's not just unimpressive, but, alarming. It's clearly putting Mr Corbyn and Labour as a security risk to this country. If you're not prepared to authorise strikes against terrorists, we've seen terrorist attacks directly inspired by ISIL in Paris just last week. He's not prepared to endorse the nuclear deterrent and would stop building our new nuclear submarines, which we've already started building in Barrow. And the other day, he even questioned our deployment in NATO. Last week I was in Estonia with British and French troops helping to deter Russian aggression on the eastern side of NATO. So this was an alarming performance, and I think shows Jeremy Corbyn and Labour as a risk to the security of this country.
And you would be happy to have first use of, as he describes it, nuclear weapons?
Yeah, we've made it very clear that you must always make sure the enemy is not sure whether you would use your deterrent or not. If you go out, if you rule out using the deterrent in any particular circumstances, you remove that uncertainty. And the whole point of the deterrent, and we use the deterrent every day, every night, 24 hours, every day of every year, we're using that deterrent to leave any potential adversaries in doubt as to how we would respond. That's the purpose of the deterrent.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we're not talking about we would use it to strike back. We're saying we don't say that we wouldn't use it first. Now, if you think about it, there's no way you can say that somebody wouldn't necessarily use it first. They might say they weren't going to use it first, but then use it first. But what we agreed in the 1970s, that we were going to take a step back from this, and everybody, for example, the ABM Treaty in 1972 between Nixon and the Soviets, was that we wouldn't have these missiles which are designed for first strike. In other words, that could knock out a retaliatory strike. But what we are doing now, what NATO is doing now, is moving first strike weapons into Estonia, into Kaliningrad, into Poland and Romania, and that then puts the Russian defences on a hair trigger, which is what happened in the 1980s when the cruise missiles were deployed. And do you know what? We nearly had a nuclear war in 1983 by accident, because the only response, when if they feel that the Russians feel that there's a danger of first strike, their only response to that is to go onto hair trigger alert. So they immediately hit back whenever they think.
But you heard Michael Fallon there. He's saying that it's really important to have a policy where your enemy, potential enemy anyway, doesn't know that you might use nuclear weapons first.
Well, we've made it pretty clear by deploying these missile systems in Romania and Poland that we are prepared to do a first strike. Now, and they're also saying, Michael Fallon's just said that we're going to do a first strike, or we're not ruling it out. Now, on that basis, the Russian general staff has to plan. They can't try and carry out a first strike. Now, our only response to that, and they haven't said this, but both the Russians and the Chinese said, we don't believe in first strikes. But what we will do is we'll put ourselves on a hair trigger alert. So if we see you coming at us in any way, shape or form, we're immediately going to go to full DEFCON 3 and we're going to retaliate. And that's what nearly happened in 1983. In actual fact, because of all the rhetoric that Reagan and Thatcher were coming out with, in actual fact, the Soviets really thought they were going to be attacked. And because they really thought they were going to be attacked, they then put all of their people on absolutely hair trigger alert, which means that everybody's on hair trigger alert all the time. And what happened was there was a flock of swans which got misinterpreted by the Soviet system as an air attack, and they nearly fired back. And the only thing that stopped them firing back, the guy decided not to follow orders, not to follow procedure, and he didn't press the button.
Okay,
and that's the only thing that saved us in 1980.
In the film I was mentioning earlier, in John Pilger's The Coming War on China, there's an incident during the Cuban Missile Crisis where there is an order to launch the nuclear force against China from the Pacific weapons that the Americans have got, and it was only some rather smart officer saying this can't be true because China is not part of this disagreement with the Soviet Union, and it was only by this guy actually threatening with a gun some officer that wanted to launch their nuclear weapons at China that stopped it happening.
Yeah, so both in the Cuban Missile Crisis and in 1983, people know about the Cuban Missile Crisis. They don't know what happened in 1983. Eventually, the Soviets had a spy at the top of NATO who was able to reassure them that NATO was bluffing and that they weren't going to carry out a first strike. But if people like Fallon say, we're going to carry out a first strike, well, the Russians are going
that's
to take
not,
you at their
on,
word.
That's not what he said, is it?
No, he did say that. He said, we are prepared to carry out a first strike. We're not going to say to the Russians, we won't attack first. Now, the Russians, it couldn't be plainer. If you were the Russian general, So what you're saying is you are prepared to attack us first. Now, in that case, we will have to take whatever measures we're going to have to take. And that includes being ready to smack you in the face really hard at a moment's notice. So if we think or suspect that you are about to carry out a first strike on us, we will have to carry out a first strike on you, because that's the implication. Now, of course, the way out of this is for everybody to deny a first strike, and we can all take a step back, and nobody's going to use nuclear weapons, are they? Surely not. But, of course, the NATO policy is to threaten to use nuclear weapons. And, of course, the Americans threatened to use nuclear weapons in Korea in the 1950s and against the North Vietnamese. And do you know what the North Vietnamese said to them? Go on, bring it on. You're bluffing. But, of course, they threatened to use them.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Another UBS whistleblower, Martin, this week. His name's Christoph Miley. I interviewed him last week for Dialect. A fascinating interview. He was around in 1997 as a security guard at the bank UBS, where he found that they were shredding a whole load of documents he found from about 110 years of people who'd made deposits in these Swiss banks and then died. And because none of the relatives had been able to claim the money, some had tried, but they couldn't get death certificates, for example, because the people had died in concentration camps. They weren't allowed to have the money. Now, we're talking about hundreds of millions of Swiss francs, sort of dollar equivalent money here. The banks are being a bit cheeky, aren't they? If you deposit the money, your relatives may know about it or not, but if they do, and you've died in the meantime, and then they try and claim it back, and then the banks even say, oh, well, you've got to show us a death certificate, otherwise we won't give you the money. And they've taken this. Basically, what they're doing is just shredding any evidence within their own building that money was ever they're there and they're stealing the goods.
Well, I mean, Swiss banks and Switzerland looks like a terribly nice place, but in all fairness, it is the home of money laundering, as is the City of London.
Anyway, let's have a listen to an extract from this interview, which went out earlier this week, actually, on Dialect, by Christoph Miley, who came to prominence in the late 1990s, having... actually, what happened was he gave the documents that he found that were about to be shredded to some Jewish groups, and then they managed to mount cases against UBS, both in Switzerland and in the United States, that led to hundreds of millions of dollars being recovered.
BITS was founded to support in World War One.
Now, he's talking about the BIS there, just to let you know. It's BIS, which is the Bank for International Settlements, which is an important... it's basically the central banker's central bank, where people like Mark Carney come from and go back to once a month to do all the regulation that led to the... or non-regulation that led to the 2008 financial crisis. So let's have a listen back now to Christoph Miley talking about BIS, or BIS, as he calls it.
They supported both sides, the Germans and the French, and then they cashed in. And the same bank was used in World War II to manage Germany. And even today, it's there's no police guy can go into that bank. It's off limits, and it's owned by private Jewish families. They also own the Federal Reserve in America, and they're all Swiss and Swiss Jewish families, Rothschilds. They're German, actually. Rothschilds, Loeb, they're in Swiss, and Moscovich, you know, the finance families. And since 200 years, they started with Napoleon, since 200 years they control the world through money creation, money printing, and they use the BITS or the Federal Reserve in Washington to control every country in the world. And but the headquarters is in Switzerland. They let other people do wars. They have white gloves, and they have their corporations and their outsource corporations that do the wars. Like right now, it's America that they use to manage all these wars around the world. But America is just in the same footstep that the Germans were. The Germans were used. They were used to rob Europe, but the money was then deposited in the Swiss banks.
Well, you know, there is definitely manipulation going on in the international system. You know, we've got to be quite precise about who we think it really is and what's going on. There are definitely important Jewish families at the core of the international ruling class. The Rothschilds are an obvious point, but it's not just them. Real money talks. You've got plenty of goy in there who aren't Jewish at all, who are just as bad.
There's also
it's not really a religious thing. It's more to do with greed and selfishness.
And also, many of these families tend to be Zionist families too, don't they?
Well, they do. I mean, but you've got to recognise that there's plenty of Christian Zionists who support the State of Israel because it's a gendarme in the Middle East for Western interests. And we've got a transnational ruling class with a substantial Jewish element within it, but it's certainly not a Jewish ruling class. I mean, it's a ruling class with some Jews in it.
But what he's saying there effectively about the Swiss banks, no matter who's controlling them, is that they have this real kind of lock hold on the creation of money, whether it's in the United States through the Federal Reserve or BIS, which was so... I mean, it's fair to say that there's no way that the Nazis could have built up all their military forces without help from this bank in Switzerland.
Well, Montagu Norman, who was the head of the Bank of England when the Nazis invaded Czechoslovakia, he argued that the gold held by the Czech for the Czech government by the Bank for International Settlements should be handed over to the new German regime in Prague, because you know, they were now the new regime and the gold belonged to them. And this was in the weeks running up to World War II. And of course, what he argued was that wars come and go, but banking goes on forever, and we mustn't, you know, the Bank of International Settlements has somehow got to be above World War II. And of course, it was used both by the Germans and the West. And of course, when at the end of World War II, as we're coming to later in this programme, deals were done between ex-Nazis and the Western powers, and NATO was set up using, you know, many of the networks that had been created by the Gestapo in Eastern Europe and elsewhere. And that explains an awful lot about why we've ended up in the mess we're in, because NATO in many ways is a continuation of that Nazi and Western elite cooperation.
Now, what about people like Reinhard Gehlen? He was quite important.
Well, Gehlen was the head of the Gestapo, and he ends up running the West German intelligence services. Now, if you were the Russians, that's a pretty clear signal about what you're dealing with in NATO, isn't it? So the former head of the Gestapo is now your intelligence chief. Right, we know what we're dealing with here.
Well, we're going to be talking a bit about Rudolf Hess later, but on this particular point from East Berlin, there was apparently something called the Brown Book on Nazi war criminals, which was circulated, which claimed that 1,800 named major offenders who the Soviet Union and the East Germans wanted to put on trial, possibly for execution, were back in key West German posts. 1,800, or drew large pensions for their work during Hitler's lifetime. Apparently, it listed 15 government ministers, 100 generals and admirals of the revived German armed forces.
Yeah, I mean, it's open knowledge, surely, that elements of the Nazi regime were rehabilitated after World War II because of the and various clandestine networks were set up, the so-called Gladio networks, using fascist intelligence operatives in order to create what were supposedly stay-behind armies to resist a Soviet invasion, but which became terrorist manipulators of West European politics. And we've covered this many times on this show. People shouldn't be surprised. Trump said NATO was obsolete, and it isn't, unfortunately, obsolete. It's horrifyingly still there, but of course it's got no real purpose other than world domination. And that's, you know, ultimately going to fail.
I mean, is it NATO just getting increasingly dangerous and crazy as it fights for its own survival?
Well, NATO is an epiphenomenon, really. I mean, if we didn't call it NATO, we'd call it something else. But it's pretty bizarre that the North Atlantic Treaty Organization is sending further reinforcements to the Hindu Kush, which is just about as far away from the North Atlantic as you could possibly go.
Also, we'll be talking about Hess in a minute, but let's take a look at the Freemasons in Nazi Germany, because this is one of the questions that I was hoping. I mean, this is something that actually that Jack Lopresti raised, who's a Freemason Conservative MP here in Bristol, when he was on this programme, and it's a very legitimate, valid question. If Hitler and the Nazis picked on the Freemasons, put them in concentration camps, etc., as they did to trade unionists, disabled, Jews, mentally ill, gypsies, etc., during the Third Reich, then surely the Freemasons are actually a persecuted bunch. I mean, anyway, so this is one of the things I was hoping, and my reviewer, former Freemason Ian Madison, was hoping was going to be tackled in this programme on the Freemasons called Inside the Freemasons, which is going out on Sky TV on Monday nights at 8 o'clock at the moment. And I think we'll probably have another review from Ian when the whole programme is finished, but it'd be a shame to miss it halfway through. So let's have a listen now to Ian Madison, former Freemason and former Army officer, so what he has to say about the Nazi persecution of Freemasons and the activities of Joseph Goebbels.
People went to the gas chambers and went to the concentration camps of various ethnic groups, etc., one of which were Masons. Yes, is what I believe, and that's what I've read. So I would tend to believe that, yes, he did that. However, if you look then at the history of what Goebbels was trying to do at Wewelsburg in the castle in southern Germany, he was trying to get the Aryan race together. And if you go the inner workings of Wewelsburg down in the cellars of there where he was trying to get this thing together, it looked very much like a similar type of checkered floor, etc., and various ornaments around the area.
Well, what you're suggesting there is that the Nazis had their own kind of version of Freemasonry, and anyone that was outside it that was would possibly be a threat.
You would not be wrong in thinking that if you saw what I saw at what was going on at Wabelsburg, yeah. Well, that was where Goebbels wanted to set up his headquarters afterwards. It's a very distinctive castle. Go on to the internet and have a look, because it's like in a triangle form with sort of round towers on the apexes of the triangles, and it's quite a sort of distinctive place. But certainly Goebbels wanted to establish back this famous Aryan race going right back into the realms of what was previously Prussia and the old German way. That's what he was trying to do.
Just one of the little bits of insight, quite a lot actually, particularly to do with the rituals that the Freemasons do, which the Sky TV people were not showing you in that series, Martin. Well, what do you make of this idea that Ian, I mean, he should know, he's been in the Freemasons as quite a senior Mason as well, before he left back in the 1990s, saying effectively that it was like everything else, that the Nazis were effectively control freaks. So anyone that wasn't in their particular group of Freemasons was potentially a threat to them.
Well, that's right. And if you go back to even earlier periods, like the 18th century, when people like Mozart were Freemasons and so on, the Freemasons, and Franco was very down on the Freemasons as well, because traditionally the Freemasons had a liberal, libertarian philosophy. They were in favour of national self-determination and so on. So they were persecuted by the conservative powers because they were seen as, you know, modernists, really. And, of course, in Nazi Germany, any organisation which wasn't under the control of the government was going to be dealt with. You know, they weren't going to tolerate any organisation other than their own organisation. So it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, presumably if you were cooperative, there wouldn't be a problem. But they're certainly not going to allow people to have secret organisations that they don't control.
Also, another thing that he points out there is that in the programme they're talking about Freemasonry as a secular society, and yet he points out that each lodge has its own chaplain. There are all sorts of quotes from the Bible, including using the Bible in there, and most of the time the chaplains in a Masonic lodge are also, for the rest of us outside, are ministers of the cloth, in other words, vicars and pastors in churches. So is it, do you think, a secular organisation or a religious
organisation? Well, no, I think as far as I understand, Freemasonry has always been an avowedly religious organisation, but with a non-denominational twist. And of course, you could argue, well, hang on a minute, how religious is it to set up, secret societies which then try to dominate, public sector contracts and so on? I think the ruling class has always, as Adam Smith said, even when they meet socially, there's some conspiracy against the public being cooked up. And if Freemasonry didn't exist, something else would be created in order to create the bonds necessary. So the Skull and Bones Society in the US isn't part of traditional Freemasonry, but it's a very important part of socialising the super ruling class, the real insiders, like many of the people in Trump's cabinet, like Mnuchin, for example. He was a Skull and Bones man.
Also, the ritual which Ian talks about in this interview, which will be aired next Tuesday at noon here on BCFM, is the threats of death when you're going in through these rituals. You've got the noose around your neck, which is obviously a threat of death. Then you've got the knife pointed touching your bare chest, a dagger actually, and then the promise that you will allow your fellow Masons to kill you if you break any of their promises. Now, this is actually a bit sinister, isn't it? And it's not like joining a golf club or something.
No, it's not. But you've got to remember when the Freemasons originally started, a lot of them were based on it was based at the time of the Carbonari, as they were called in Italy. And these secret societies were revolutionary societies which were dedicated to the overthrow of, foreign domination of Italy or whatever. And this kind of melodramatic, may my tongue be cut out or whatever. That's the kind of, you've got to remember that back in that era, that sort of thing was regarded as kind of fairly normal. And if you think about the Tolpuddle martyrs in England, they were convicted of swearing unlawful oaths, and what they had was a big picture of a skeleton, and that people were told to swear that they would serve, that they would be loyal to the the Grand National Consolidated Trade Union. Otherwise, you know, there would be consequences, and they would die, and so on. This sort of thing sounds sinister today, but you've got to remember the context in which these things originally evolved, which was of secret societies led by romantic students attempting to overthrow what they saw as oppressive governments. And, of course, it still carries on. And, of course, Freemasonry today is largely accused of being a club for the super wealthy elite to fix things behind the scenes.
Well, it's, isn't it about privilege and promotion? The other thing is, is it a religious cult? It seems to be. Also, you know, you're talking about these oaths, having my throat cut across, my tongue torn out by the root and buried in the sand of the sea at low water mark or a cable's length from the shore where the tide regularly ebbs and flows twice in 24 hours. That's just for the first degree. Now, this does remind me of the death of that banker in London, Roberto Calvi
was found hanging from, I think it was Blackfriars Bridge, with bricks in his pocket and so on. And, of course, he was involved in the Vatican Bank, which had been very much involved in the financing behind things like Gladio, which was running the terrorist networks in Italy during that period. So, we know these things go on. We don't know as much as we ought to, but P2 Propaganda Duo was the lodge in Italy which was at the centre of the Gladio scandal. All the top sort of military industrialists and so on were in it, and they were coordinating all of the terrorism in Italy, according to Imposimato, the head of the Italian Supreme Court.
Well, thanks for bringing up Gladio again, Martin, but that is a perfect cue to introduce one of the most important stories I've seen for a long time. A German soldier posing as a Syrian refugee has been arrested for planning a false flag terror attack at Vienna Airport. Investigators say this lieutenant stashed a gun at Vienna Airport, which was going to be used in an act of state-threatening violence. Now, the troubling thing is that he felt confident, this German soldier, apparently, that he was going to be able to blame this on Syrian refugees.
Well, as I understand it, what he'd done is he'd registered himself as a refugee, and therefore he'd had to give his fingerprints, and he was going to carry out the attack with the gun and escape and leave the gun with his fingerprints on it, which would then lead to the Syrian refugee that he'd been pretending to be getting the blame for the attack. Now, it may be that this is a far-right nationalist soldier who's operated on his own. I think the Austrian police or whoever's caught him have done a very good job here. Because we need more of this. We need to catch these people red-handed. And
it's the German police.
German police.
And also, it's worth mentioning that more than 90 German police officers have been set on this case. They've worked alongside Austrian and French security forces, searching 16 locations across three countries, and a suspected accomplice has been arrested in Bavaria.
Yeah. Well, it may be that this is this has been orchestrated by those with political motivation, to try and blame refugees, etc. And, of course, that needs to be given publicity, just like, Anders Behring Breivik killing scores of Labour Party young socialists in Norway. I mean, these are the terrorists. But on the other hand, I think what we've really got to ask the question is, was he operating alone, or was he operating as part of a Gladio-style provocational network?
Well, investigations.
Because that is the Dortmund beer hall massacre of the 90s was definitely orchestrated from the intelligence services.
Investigations revealed the Bundeswehr lieutenant was stationed at Ilkirch Grafenstaden in France. Doesn't sound very French, but anyway, that's before registering as a refugee back in Germany. He gave false information to authorities in Gießen, Hesse, back in 2015, as Germany was overwhelmed by the arrival of almost a million asylum seekers. He apparently spoke French rather than Arabic. The man submitted an asylum application at Zindorf in Bavaria in January last year. As a result, he was given shelter in a refugee home. Amazing that someone can live such a total double life. I mean, is he an undercover agent?
That's got to be the suspicion. Because of what we know about the way the intelligence services have orchestrated these networks in the past, including things like the Dortmund Beer Hall massacre in Germany, the assassination.
I mean, how easy is it to get hold of a fake Syrian passport?
Well, you don't even need a Syrian passport. You just say, "I've run away from Syria. I'm Syrian. I'm speaking in French, not Arabic." And then, of course, he presumably wants going to carry out the attack, and then he's going to disappear into the woodwork, and Syrian refugees will be blamed, so that you can bring in more police powers in Germany. It'll encourage the far right to say that these terrible people are killing people in airports, even though in actual fact it's the far right itself that's doing it.
Well, look, hang on, because the soldier was arrested only just a few days after prosecutors revealed the man who orchestrated the Dortmund bus bombings had attempted to frame ISIS to make money on shares. I mean, these don't sound like terrorists to me. Sergei W. A. Dual German Russian national detonated 3 bombs targeting a bus carrying the Borussia Dortmund football team, seriously injuring one player on the 11th of April. He left misspelled letters, deliberately, it seems, at the scene, claiming the attack was a retaliation for German military intervention against ISIS. But investigators found he wasn't an Islamist, but a trader planning to profit from short-selling shares. I mean, is that terrorism? I suppose it is.
Of course it is. It's all terrorism. Nobody disputes that.
Let's make a few bob.
What we may have here is opportunists of the far right or of the money-making variety.
The other thing is, you know, we have told all about this Dortmund bus bombing of the football team, but nothing hardly about the fact that the guy was, all he was planning to do was to make a few bob at it.
Well, I mean, we're bombarded with all sorts of information all the time and a lot of misinformation. The fact is that the record shows that NATO's intelligence service have been deeply involved in fomenting terrorism over the last 50 years, and Islamist terrorism in particular.
Also, Martin, at least 2 neo-Nazi terror plots have been uncovered in Germany, while security services have cracked down on the anti-government Reichsbürger movement after one of its members killed a police officer. We hear hardly anything about these white non-Muslim terrorists, do we?
No, we don't, because they're not proper terrorists. They're just, you know... I mean, it's like the killing of Joe Cox. Was that terrorism? Yes, of course it was. The question is, how much of this is orchestrated? And I suspect the strategy of tension is the way it's always been. The intelligence services are running Islamist terrorism, right-wing terrorism, and then demanding more powers to deal with it.
As ever, this will be a link to this article up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But finally, Martin, Rudolf Hess, why did he spend 42 years in jail? Why did his family not allowed to speak to him during that time? He spent over 20 years in Spandau Prison in Berlin. Even though he was the only prisoner there, he was allowed to just see his relatives once for half an hour every Christmas, but he wasn't allowed to have any proper conversations with them, and they weren't allowed to record anything about what he'd spoken to them. Now, one of the main reasons that I've just been reading this book called The Bormann Brotherhood, which is by William Stevenson, published in 1973. William Stevenson was a Canadian journalist, TV producer, back during the Second World War and after. He said he wrote the book because he said it was quite clear to him that the West is becoming a deepening nightmare. This is in the 1970s, because there were so many Nazis seem to be in key positions.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a general knowledge about this for years, but I don't think people realise how deeply Nazi intelligence networks were embedded in the very creation of NATO. And, of course, the techniques used, which include false flag terrorism, i.e. carrying out an attack, pretending it's somebody else, in order to get more power, that's very similar to what the Nazis did in the 30s, but it's much more sophisticated.
2 take-homes from this. One is that the head of the Gestapo, Heinrich Müller, who was actually trained in the early 1920s, in the Soviet Union, as it was at the time, after the Bolshevik Revolution. And that's where he learnt his techniques as the head of Gestapo, which does make you wonder, how close, actually, some people have accused the Nazi regime and the Bolshevik regime of having rather too many things in common. But the main reason was because before the Second World War, Hess had been involved in a secret agreement between Hitler and Stalin to invade Poland, and had divided it up, and that was because the beginning of the Second World War. Well, so perhaps that's why they didn't want Hess to be able to talk. to particularly to the press.
Well, I mean, this is speculation. We don't know what Hess knew because that's why they kept.
Well, if you want, I'll put some of this evidence from this book by this Canadian journalist in the 1970s.
Well, I mean, everybody knows that at that period, Hitler and Stalin were cooperating quite closely, and therefore their various intelligence services and military were cooperating quite closely. The Germans were intending to double cross the Russians all along, but the Russians were too stupid to realise.
Well, one does wonder whether people like Desmond Morton and Bormann had actually, you know, knew about these people like Müller, etc. It's certainly that Müller certainly seems to have survived the war because his grave was said. We think that he's there. There was a grave found and it had three bones from three different bodies in it. It certainly wasn't him. Anyway, I think it's time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. I'll put some links up to that quotes from that book about Rudolf Hess. Coming up live on Facebook, it's Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi and Yusuf. Thanks to our guests in the first hour. That's community activists from Hartcliffe, Kerry Bales and Steve Norman from Avonmouth. Also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon every Tuesday. This show's story links and comments page is one word, thisweek.org.uk. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car, iPlayer or anywhere you like. You'll find me on Twitter during the week at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Billy Quain, Saturday edition tomorrow morning, 10 till 12. All the way through till The Real Musical Deal, Sunday evening, 7 till 8 with Danny Lopsch. I'll leave you with music from 2006. Yes, it's the other Freemasons. Do please join us at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, Fighting Fake News, we'll be listening to a speech that I gave at Sonoma State University for Social Justice Week in April of 2017. The talk, Critical Media Literacy Education, the Antidote to Fake News, Propaganda, and Censorship in a Post-Truth World. Stay with us.
About criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, skies, another kind of democracy, politics, the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips will return next week. On today's program, we'll be listening to a keynote lecture I was invited to deliver at Sonoma State University's third annual Social Justice Week in April of 2017. The talk focuses on the significance of education and critical thinking skills in order to navigate our increasingly saturated digital world. While noting current definitions of so-called fake news, I go into detail about how fake news is actually nothing new and has a quite long and sordid history, particularly in the guise of propaganda. On today's show, Fighting Fake News, the importance of critical media literacy education in a digital age. Here is that talk.
The focus of the talk this evening is critical media literacy education, the antidote to fake news, media filters, and propaganda in a post-truth world. Let's start here. Does anybody remember last year when Oxford Dictionary, the Oxford Dictionaries folks, they pick a word every year, a word that has significant meaning or reflection on things that are going on. And in 2016, guess what the word of the year was? Post-truth. Hyphenated word. See, the word of the year can be hyphenated. Post-truth. And by this they're saying it's an adjective defined as relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. Seemed to be a little bit of that going on last year during the election season, where there was a proliferation of a lot of information coming through particularly social media. And over the last several years, social media platforms have become one of the main places where people go to get information. And we're going to get into this here a little later. But that's not to say that some places like Facebook or Twitter are actually journalistic sources or news sources, because they're not. But yet, when polled, if you take a look at the Pew Research Center, when polling people for where most Americans get their news, most people from the United States get their news, I'm clarifying that, they say that it's a social media platform. We're going to come back to that a few different times here. And so in this climate of post-truth, we encountered this phenomenon. It's not a new one, but we had this new label that crept into social media memes, and it started to get picked up in corporate news outlets, and even major political parties like the Democratic National Committee started sort of running this idea that we live in a culture where fake news has some kind of effect on the outcomes of what's going on with people. So I know I'm talking about several different things right now, and it's going to be that way for a minute, but all these things are going to converge here momentarily. So let's hold on to post-truth, and then with post-truth, we will have emerge fake news. But a big part of how this fake news meme gets rolling and where it goes is it eventually transforms itself into the world of alternative facts. We remember Kellyanne Conway, counsel to President Donald Trump, after the inauguration when Press Secretary Sean Spicer insisted that it was among the biggest and most attended inaugurations in history. Journalists, you know, pesky as they may be with facts, clearly showed that this was a falsehood. And Kellyanne Conway, when trying to sort of skirt the obviousness of the falsehood of these statements, just blurted out that Spicer was referring to alternative facts. Now, to their credit, some in the corporate media, like Chuck Todd, will footnote him, bookmark him. We'll come back to say, roundly criticize him in a minute. But Todd rightfully called her on this and said that there are no such things as alternative facts. What you mean is falsehoods. The alternative to a fact is a fiction. But that didn't stop, right, the use of the term alternative facts. And it hasn't stopped the term fake news either. So post-truth was word of the year. And alternative facts, right, like Orwell's 2 + 2 = 5, right, are now upon us. And where do we see alternative facts? Well, we apparently see them in so-called fake news. So notice these concepts are converging. In fact, once Kellyanne Conway blurted out this phrase, alternative facts, veteran CBS journalist Dan Rather, footnote, bookmark him, we can come back to roundly criticize Dan as well. But here's Dan Rather after retirement, who's actually been quite the cheerleader for a fierce and independent free press, one that he kind of didn't really do much to make when he was there. But since retirement, he's been quite a vicious critic of corporate media, and he has spearheaded a lot of free press movements. Here is what Dan Rather had to say about Sean Spicer's press conference and Kellyanne Conway's follow-up comments. Rather said, "These are not normal times. These are extraordinary times. And extraordinary times call for extraordinary measures. When you have a spokesperson for the President of the United States wrap up a lie in the Orwellian phrase, alternative facts, When you have a press secretary in his first appearance before the White House reporters threaten, bully, lie, and then walk out of the briefing room without the cojones to answer a single question, facts and the truth are not partisan. Rather went on to say, they are the bedrock of our democracy, and you are either with them, with us, with our Constitution, our history, and the future of our nation, or you're against it. Might be paraphrasing George W. Bush there a little bit, with us or against us. But Rather said everybody must answer this question, and what he's getting at is he's suggesting that we can't live in a world where people pretend to have alternative facts as reasonable means by which to support their positions. Mark Twain had an interesting way of putting that kind of a sentiment, where he said, get your facts first, then you can distort them as much as you please. you can twist them, you can spin them. As the late senator from New York, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, once said, we're all entitled to our own opinions, we're not entitled to our own facts. That means no alternative facts. So this is how we kind of get into early this year, and we're still dealing a lot with the phenomenon of fake news, alternative facts, in a post-truth world. But let's back up a minute. Let's back up a minute and take a look at sort of a history of some of this kind of affair. It's not new. I've been doing a lot of talks on this subject lately, from Los Angeles to up in Ashland. I was just in Sacramento at the Journalism Association Community College Conference. I've been getting a lot of phone calls, and we've been getting a lot of requests for interviews. So we can at least say that in this last year, the way things have gone, suddenly people are starting to turn on to this idea that we live in a world that is addled with deception and falsehoods. The way that I've actually been describing it more broadly recently is I think that where we are right about now is in the throes of an epistemological crisis, where we live in a society where people have a very hard time discerning fact from fiction, or fact from opinion, alternative fact from actual fact. And this isn't new either. Almost a decade ago, Peter Phillips and I and others at Project Censored, we said that we were living in a truth emergency, that we lived in a society where we were awash in a sea of information, in a digital age where we have so much information at our fingertips, yet we have a paucity of understanding about what it means, where we lack the ability to connect the dots. And of course, over the period of the late 20th century, we were taught that we were supposed to trust professors or experts or journalists and others to try to help us sort that out. And if you go back in the 20th century, we found, you know, there were definitely stalwart characters, whether it's Ida Tarbell or Molly Ivins, if it's Lincoln Steffens or George Seldes, right, who said in the mid-20th century the job of journalists is to tell people what's actually going on, so they can understand it in a way that's meaningful for them to participate in a representative democratic republic. You can put air quotes around that if you want. We can come back to that later. So this issue of establishing information integrity is ongoing. It's a long one. But the current crisis we're in didn't just come out of nowhere. And, of course, at Project Censored, we've been noticing problems with the news media and censorship and propaganda and junk food news, sensationalist, titillating distraction, and so forth, for 40 years. So, again, all of a sudden, now when we see a heightened sense of awareness and interest in the public, the Pew poll, recent Pew poll suggested that roughly 60% of the American public believes that fake news is a crisis. It's a real problem. So, again, hold on to those numbers, because we're eventually, after we outline the history of the development of these problems, we're going to spend some time on what have been the recent solutions proposed, what do I think is wrong with those solutions, and what solution do we propose, at least in addition to, if not outright instead, of the proposed solutions to combating fake news. Well, I already gave the answer away in the title of the talk, so spoiler alert there. Nevertheless, about 10 years ago, I mentioned we coined this term truth emergency, but the term fake news was floating around 10 years ago in the popular culture, and you probably know where. It was on Comedy Central with Stephen Colbert and the Colbert Report, where satire sort of took on this label of fake news, but it was done in a way that was fairly obvious, at least to some, that the purpose was to lampoon the nature of corporate media and commentators and opinion journalism, which had basically taken over through Fox and MSNBC and so forth. But fake news If you really want to go back and take a look at fake news, this is the problem that we face currently with these issues, is that there are so many iterations and definitions of it floating around. And equivocation is a problem with it, because what happens when the Democratic National Committee started floating fake news last spring and last summer, and they were worried about news stories on social media potentially influencing the outcome of the election after they helped Keaton in the primary and have Hillary, sorry about that, Freudian slip, came out. After this took place, and November comes around, and the Democrats find themselves 3 million votes ahead and still losing because of the Electoral College. Well, footnote that, this is not going to turn into a talk about the Electoral College either. But a lot of people began looking around because the so-called experts that we've been trained to trust, they all kind of looked at each other and they said, what happened? How were we all wrong? Right? Whether it was Nate Silver and his magic numbers or the DNC chair or the establishment. I mean, they were so confident that they were winning. Let's remember that they did win the popular vote, please. But they were so confident that they didn't even bother to go and campaign in a lot of the Rust Belt states where things were, well, close enough to tip. And so November of last year, the fake news meme kind of blew up. And the Democratic Party said, we know that fake news is involved in helping tip the election. These teenagers in Macedonia were pumping out a bunch of fake news for money. And Putin was helping through WikiLeaks. Never mind what WikiLeaks was leaking were actual emails from John Podesta that proved the rank corruption of the Democrats and the Clinton campaign. Put that aside. But we're supposed to be focusing on how fake news is this big problem that's capable of tipping the outcome of elections, right? And again, all the while, Peter and I and other folks at Project Censored and people that kind of study and follow media and propaganda history are kind of looking around and seeing like, yeah, there's definitely a lot of fake news going on, but this has been going on forever. I'm not sure we're all talking about the same thing. So what happened, as you know, with the fake news meme is that Washington Post started picking it up, and the sort of Democratic establishment and the corporate press were all kind of trying to figure out, well, you know, social media is kind of responsible for letting this genie out of the bottle. And so there was this great focus on how social media was responsible for fake news. Remember what we just said about social media a little bit ago about not being a news platform in the first place? I don't know. I guess you can stretch the definition of fake news as much as you need. But Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook, his initial reaction to the finger-pointing coming at him, he kind of laughed it off and said, Facebook, man, people post pictures of kittens and things like that, and you're telling me that we get the balance of the election. We're not a news platform. Well, apparently the PR handlers over at Facebook kind of reeled him in and said, hey, Mark, these people are angry, and they have a lot of money, and they think that you're not taking seriously your role in society in terms of how information now flows through social media, and it's not vetted and or fact-checked. And so what are you going to do about that? And so Zuckerberg said, okay, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. If fact-checking is the solution to this problem, we'll hire some fact-checkers. And then it was Snopes and PolitiFact, even ABC News, and their fact-checking division was called on board, even though the PolitiFact had found some 40% of their coverage false in certain stories. We'll forget about that riff there. But Snopes and PolitiFact, anybody read those? Anybody go there and read those? No? Nobody? They're useful tools for pointing out some things that that should get us thinking. But the real insidious component of places like Snopes and PolitiFact is that people go there as like it's a one-stop shop, and they're like, Snopes said it's bogus. Click, off, done, move along. And they don't ask other questions, and they don't do their own research, and they're not really thinking critically. They're outsourcing this key component of news consumption. That's critical thinking. Thinking about it, asking questions about it, looking at the sourcing, the dates, the bylines, all these things. So from the PolitiFact and Snopes kind of episode, the Washington Post ran an article by Craig Timberg, a former national security editor, who out of the blue propped up this website called Prop or Not, which stood for Propaganda or Not, because it's that simple, right? And Propaganda or Not just kind of came out of right field. I was careful about that. And it labeled prominent websites or independent alternative websites, more obscure websites, and it labeled them fake news or conspiracy sites. And here's Craig Timberg, an editor, a journalist. He, and it's not just him, it was the senior editor at the Washington Post, Marty Baron. Oh, on Twitter, oh man, we found the culprit. Proper Knot is on the case. Well, it turns out, they didn't know their methodology. They don't know who they are. It's an anonymous group of people. We can't find out where they're funded. And here's the Washington Post holding it up as the gold standard of information integrity. Well, a few days later, some of the threats and lawsuits started pouring in, like Naked Capitalism, Counterpunch, you know, websites that have a partisan agenda, but are clearly not in the business of fake news. And a lot of the sites that were listed as fake news are independent journalistic outlets that we've had in our books over the years. And we know that they've been fact-checked and vetted, and we know they're actual news sites. So this is actually a thinly disguised attempt for Dinosaur Media, the Washington Post, to attack online new rivals that people can now click and see, and lump them all in an obfuscation, right? A big pool of obfuscation. That we can put obvious sites that are fake that say so right on their about page. We can pretend it's somehow the same as The Onion or Satire, and then we can just lump in a few anti-establishment real journalism sites and throw them all in the trash together. Well, the Washington Post gradually had to retract their statements. Here's their retraction. The Washington Post on November 24 published a story on the work of four sets of researchers who have examined what they say are Russian propaganda efforts to undermine American democracy and interests. So Jeffrey St. Clair at Counterpunch is now like a Russian spy? Again, the absurdity is, just on the face of it, is pretty astounding. And his quips and jokes about it online were quite timely and funny. One of them was Proper Knot, a group that insists on public anonymity, which issued a report identifying more than 200 websites that, in its view, wittingly or unwittingly published or echoed Russian propaganda. A number of those sites have objected to being included on Proper Knot's list, and some of the sites, as well as others not on the list, have publicly challenged the group's methodology and conclusions. The Post, which did not name any of the sites, does not itself vouch for the validity of Proper Knot's findings regarding any individual media outlet, nor did the article purport to do so. Since publication of the Post story, Proper Knot has removed some of the sites from its lists. But remember, I just told you that Marty Baron, the senior editor at the Washington Post, summed up, cheerled, and stood right behind this publication highlighting Proper Knot. So this retraction is an alternative fact. To a talk that I recently gave at Sonoma State University for Social Justice Week on critical media literacy education as the antidote to fighting so-called fake news, propaganda, and censorship in a world of alternative facts. And of course, it's been called a post-truth world, which was Oxford Dictionary's Word of the Year last year. After this break, we'll continue that talk. Stay with us. Speaking of fake news, once the fake news kind of meme was running through the corporate press and political parties were using it to blame for the loss of the election of Hillary Clinton, now it's all this morass of Trump and Putin all the time. And if you want a menage a trois, throw in Julian Assange. And somehow that's sort of this explanation for what's going on, even though they have provided no evidence that the Russians actually hacked the election. Not zero evidence has been made public about that issue. But this is where the fake news meme is running as a weapon. Fake news is now a weaponized meme, and it's now weaponized language. But you know the problem with that kind of language is that eventually it gets off leash. And now President Donald Trump took that term and said, hey, oh, we're okay. The Washington Post can run this shadowy website, PropNot, that calls sources fake news without providing any evidence. Because they apparently disagree with what's going on. And the Democratic establishment apparently thinks things that they don't like can be called fake news. So what does Donald Trump do? He does what he does best, right? He turns it into an infotainment cluster, you know what? And he screams over the podium at Jim Acosta from CNN and he says, you're fake news. And then they proceed to label journalists that they don't want to talk to as fake news. So this is this weaponization of the term that gets off leash, and now what are you going to do? Now, basically, the term fake news, which basically, in our definitions, going back through the 20th century, it's propaganda. Disinformation is purposefully erroneous information that's put out to deceive the public. Misinformation is erroneous information, but it may be mistaken. Now, both can have not great results in terms of having an informed electorate. But fake news is something now that we really need to trace back. We need to go and we need to take a look at what this term really is about. You know, George Lakoff, the linguist from Berkeley, actually did a piece on this, and he said, you know, the real kind of conundrum here is like an Orwellian doublespeak. When you put the word fake in front of something like fake gun, it totally changes what's going on with that. Fake news, those are lies. They're falsehoods. So at the root of that, again, is this epistemological problem of discerning between fact or fiction, what's true, what's false. Well, let's take a walk back historically, and let's take a little bit of a look at some of this real problem of fake news. Oh, by the way, real quick, back to the Washington Post. The Washington Post, Margaret Sullivan in the style page, she wrote later in early January after 2016, she wrote, it's time to retire the term fake news. And I said, well, how fitting that the Washington Post that helps catapult it into the lexicon also gets to retire it after it gets off leash and is used against them. And remember that this is the same Washington Post that ran a story about how the Russians allegedly hacked a power grid in Vermont, which never happened. They never vetted it. They never fact-checked it. In other words, if you had a student writing for the Sonoma State Star and they ran a story like that, they would flunk. They'd get an F. Because they didn't fact check, they didn't ask for corroborating information, they did nothing. They just ran with it. In other words, they're publishing fake news. Here's another one of those bookmark footnotes. Let's remember also what the Washington Post is. Who bought the Washington Post a few years ago? Amazon's Jeff Bezos. About 3 months after Bezos bought the Post, he got a $600 million contract from the CIA. So just going back through history, let's think about the role of the CIA in media manipulation. Whether you want to go back to Carl Bernstein in the 1977 Rolling Stone, go back to Frank Wisner, go back to the Mighty Wurlitzer, go back to Chapter 6 of Censor 2017 that looks at an entire history of CIA media manipulation, particularly through the Washington Post and the New York Times. So the rhetorical question to you, using the parlance of our day, fake news, is that fake news too? Was it fake news when Judith Miller wrote about weapons of mass destruction in the New York Times for weeks and months on end? Was it fake news when Lyndon Johnson pushed the press to cover the bogus Gulf of Tonkin incident that didn't take place, that sparked a massive war that killed over 3 million Vietnamese? So, yes, let's look at fake news. Let's really look at that. And I am all in favor of retiring that term, by the way. But more importantly, let's retire the practice. Well, let's see. The history. This will be brief. As someone that's an historian by trade, that's nearly impossible, but I'll make an effort. Let's go back to the era of yellow journalism in the early 20th century, sensationalist journalism. It was ironically at the height of the muckraking era that we saw the rise of yellow journalism that kind of grabbed onto the coattails of many of the early muckrakers when McClure's and a lot of the magazines and papers figured out these stories about unmasking corruption, they sell. People like that. And in the so-called progressive era, a lot of people in the United States used the information from these in-depth reports to reform the political system. So journalism had a real root purpose. purpose. In fact, Carl Jensen, the founder of Project Censored, wrote a book called Muckrakers of the 20th Century that looks at 21 of the key muckrakers in the 20th century, and he called it Stories That Changed America. That's a very significant history. But rivaling that were these people that were just on hire, and they were like, look, we can pump out these stories really fast and grab the eyeballs, and people will really buy these papers because they want to hear this corruption and this lascivious business and on and on. Well, what happened is the stories got sloppier and sloppier, and the muckrakers had a real challenge in terms of doing their actual job, sort of in the din or the noise of that era's junk food news. But we know that there have always been these issues. Now, I'm going to kick it up a notch into the period of World War I, referred to as the Great War at that time because they weren't cynical enough to call it World War I when it was happening, right? That would be cynical, right? But wait till next time. It'll be bigger. It'll be worse. We'll call it World War II. But in the Great War, there was a real problem that was going on in the United States. And the problem was a political problem, and the American public did not want to enter that war. They were opposed to that war. Woodrow Wilson ran in 1916 a re-election campaign based on he kept us out of war. So Wilson purposely campaigned on the popular notion that the United States would not officially enter this war. Except Wilson had a democracy problem. Even though a majority of people did not want to go into the war, Wilson's backers, the banks and the munitions industry, were already in it. And they were kind of tugging and pulling him and saying, what do you mean you're not going to get into this full blown? There's money to be made. Well, that's when Wilson helped create the Committee on Public Information, which was the first official government propaganda agency. And he populated it with people like George Creel, who was also called the Creel Commission. And George Creel brought in people like Edward Bernays, the nephew of Sigmund Freud, who used many of his uncle's ideas about how to manipulate people by appealing to their emotions and feelings as a way of trying to manipulate the entire public. In other words, Bernays said, you know, if you can manipulate one or two people, why can't you manipulate a bunch of people? And so the Creel Commission's job was to gradually convince the American public not only that the war in Europe was important and based on threats to U.S. interests, but that it was in fact of dire consequence that the U.S. get involved to help end it. And then this is when the propaganda campaign began, that the war was called the War to End All Wars. How's that working for us? The War to Make the World Safe for Democracy. How's that working for us? Well, these are powerful slogans when wrapped in nationalism, patriotism, jingoism, fear. They start to work out. So the Creel Commission actually brought in about 75,000 volunteers. 75,000. That traveled the country. This is before commercial radio. It's obviously before the phones and internets and TVs and all the jazz, right? So there's newspapers, there's public halls, there's movie theaters, and wow, were they popular. Silent movies don't have the talkies till 1927 or 8, but they were very popular, especially in the cities where a lot of growing populations, right? And so these folks targeted city hall, they targeted churches, town squares, and movies. And these characters called themselves Four-Minute-Men. Minutemen, the typical person living in the United States who had any U.S. history at all, says, Minutemen, back to the revolution. We can be ready to defend the country in a minute's notice. Well, by the 20th century, it took 4 minutes. They had more to do, I guess. But they were still called Four-Minute-Men. But why did they call them Four-Minute-Men? How long did it take to change a movie reel in a theater? About 4 minutes. So these people would parade in front of the audience between films and say, we've got a big issue going on here that you need to start taking more seriously. The Germans are ripping the arms off of Belgian babies and can invade Red Bank, New Jersey in 3 weeks. Those were alternative facts. Those were falsehoods. But they were able to whip up enough fear and concern in the public over a year, 6 months to a year period, that the Committee on Public Information was able to sway public opinion, and then Wilson had the numbers he needed to not just take the country to war, but to go headlong into it. Passed the Espionage Act, the Sedition Act that made it a crime to criticize the war effort, and passed the Conscription Act to force people to serve. And over a million people then signed it. Eugene Debs, the Socialist Party leader, was thrown in prison for 10 years for speaking out against the war. trying to convince workers that this was not their war, that this was a banker's war. And he was sent to prison for 10 years. He was pardoned, strangely enough, by the Republican Warren Harding just after. But nevertheless, was jailed for that. And Debs was a fairly well-known person at the time. He ran for president 6 times, once for prison, getting 1 million votes. Let me just give you a real quick look. This kind of distills what Edward Bernays was doing. And after what they did in World War I, Bernays wrote a book in 1928 called, literally, Propaganda. And Edward Bernays lived a long time. He was 101, I believe, when he died. And he was one of the masterminds behind so many commercial campaigns for advertising, as well as coup d'etats and government overthrows. He had a long career in propaganda. After World War I, one of his biggest claims to fame was the Torches of Freedom campaign. That was tying into the women's right to vote, women's suffrage. And then now the cigarette companies are saying, like, hey, what would happen if women actually could smoke in public and it wasn't seen like a bad thing? We could be selling twice as many cigarettes. So Bernays wrapped it up. Torches of freedom. You're expressing your individuality and getting cancer at the same time. But don't worry about that. You're free. And it was a very, very, very popular campaign. Well, here in a nutshell is what Bernays says in 1928. Doesn't matter whether you're selling cigarettes or war. The approach is the same. And this is where we're ripping on fake news and propaganda. Bernays said that, quote, the conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Rewind that. The conscious and intelligent manipulation, meaning on purpose, is an important element in democratic society, manipulating the masses. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. Sounds like a deep state. We are governed, our minds molded, our tastes formed, our ideas suggested largely by people we have never heard of. This is the logical result of the way in which our democratic society is organized. Vast numbers of human beings must cooperate in this manner if they're to live together as a smoothly functioning society. In almost every act of our daily lives, whether in the sphere of politics or business, in our social conduct or our ethical thinking, we are dominated by the relatively small number of persons who understand the mental processes and social patterns of the masses. It is they who pull the wires which control the public mind. He is arguing that propaganda is the necessary tool for population control in modern industrial democracies. Information control, not press freedom. Information control from elites who need to manipulate the bewildered herd as you. Because, as Hamilton would say, you're too stupid and ignorant. The elites need to govern you and help you, and you'll all be happier for it. Well, the condescension dripping from that kind of sensibility is hard to miss. And it's important to note that propaganda does go on to be kind of a dirty word. When we talk about propaganda nowadays, we see it as a problem. And of course, it's Joseph Goebbels and the Nazis and others that helped make it a dirty word, but who was the intellectual mentor of Goebbels and the Nazis' propaganda machine? Edward Bernays. Admittedly so, the Nazis bragged about the brilliance of the American propagandists. Hitler even wrote about it in Mein Kampf, saying, we get a chance to do that, we're going to whip up some kind of really cool propaganda campaign, too. And boy, did they ever. And of course, after this is why propaganda is something that the others do. In the United States, we just report the news. And if you go to other countries, their propaganda is called the news, too, and everything we do is called propaganda. So notice how that just goes round and round and round. Well, I'll give you another example. Who today would be maybe one of these unseen people behind the scenes kind of helping sway public opinion by what they choose to report or show? You'd be surprised to know that I've got several answers and examples for that. Here's one. The whole Trump phenomenon as a campaign, consumers, of course, were captivated by Trump's outrageous behavior. In fact, Les Moonves, the chairman of the board, president, and CEO of CBS, back where Dan Rather used to be, Walter Cronkite. Remember Walter Cronkite? He was actually a fan of Project Censored. We've come a long way since Walt, of course. Les Moonves admitted that Trump coverage led to increased profits, and he noted, while speaking at a tech conference in San Francisco in the summer of 2016, quote, I've never seen anything like this. This is going to be a very good year for us. Sorry. It's a terrible thing to say. Bring it on, Donald. Keep going. It may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS. In fact, former CBS anchorman Dan Rather warned that Trump and the media act as business partners. The corporate media's obsession with the Donald helped change the U.S. democratic process to an unholy hybrid of keeping up with the Kardashians and American Idol. In fact, 75% of Americans agreed that the corporate media covered Trump too often. Yet they kept doing it. Anyway, lots more examples like that, but that kind of really helps bring us up to the present when we talk about propaganda. And in fact, the propaganda that Edward Bernays talked about, he used very specific terms. Some of you may remember terms that came out of the early 20th century industrial America, like Taylorism, the infatuation with measuring down to the minute metric to maximize efficiency and industrial production, kind of like we do that now with testing in schools, pedagogical Taylorism. But that's another topic we're not talking about right now. But that is part of the propaganda. You students know if it's not on the test, it's not for it. Okay, well, who is controlling the tests? Oh, some of the corporations that publish the same textbooks. Who lobby in Sacramento and D.C. to help create education code? The propaganda has all kinds of outlets, doesn't it? Part of this propaganda included terms like manufacturing consent or engineering opinion. Some of you may have come in early and you saw we were playing the Conspiracy Theory Schoolhouse Rock video, and I also played a recent video with Amy Goodman talking about Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman's propaganda model and media filters. Chomsky and Herman in 1988 wrote a book called Manufacturing Consent, riffing on Bernays. But instead of engineering opinion or manufacturing consent as the way to govern modern industrial democracies, Chomsky and Herman said this is the key campaign of deception and controlling the public mind. So they criticized the influences, and they traced five of them. Ownership of the media, advertisers, where the media owners get their profits, selling your eyeballs to them. Sourcing, the reliance on only official sources to control the narrative, frame and marginalize dissent or other unpopular ideas. Flack, or feedback, and the last was ideological bias, fear, anti-communism in the Cold War, anti-terrorism post 9/11, Russia-phobia now. So they put their fingers on these five things, and Michael Peretti, for the 20th anniversary of Project Censored, wrote an essay on mass media manipulation that talked about nine features that are used to skew news, like framing and follow-up avoidance, like omission or sliding of content, attacking, labeling, these kinds of things. So we know that there are things we can put in the critical media literacy toolbox, there's that term again, that help us become more discerning, more intelligent consumers of information. That's the antidote to fake news and propaganda. Not censorship, not blacklisting, not proper not Snopes, but critical media literacy education, where you are in the driver's seat of your own mind. Remember Emma Goldman? Anarchist feminist, early 20th century, before she was deported on the Soviet arc because she was too radical in Wilson's propagandized America, said the most unpardonable sin in society is independence of thought. Well, what democracy needs to thrive are a lot more sinners. And what we've been doing for 40 years at Project Censored is we've been promoting critical media literacy education as the antidote to propaganda. Fake news is propaganda. The fact that it's dressed up and with new memes and new examples doesn't change the fact that this has been going on for a very long time. So this is also why when we've been giving a lot of these talks, that's one of the first things we say, is we say, well, this has been going on for a long time. There's nothing really new about these things. Listening to the Project Censored Show, I'm Mickey Huff. On today's show, we're listening to Critical Media Literacy Education as the antidote to fake news, propaganda, and censorship in a post-truth world. After this break, we'll continue that talk. Stay with us. solutions. I just gave you what I thought ours is, but let me go back and be specific about some of the solutions that are going on and why I don't think they're working. Snopes and PolitiFact are noble if they get people thinking critically and they can be transparently sourced and they get people down the road of thinking more independently and then doing more and more research. That's certainly a good thing and it's helpful. But we have to remember that these places also have agendas, and they also have funding, and they also have biases. And I have had teams of students that work every semester on finding Snopes and PolitiFact stories that are distorted or skewed or spun or false themselves. So this isn't just the easy out. This is why we keep going back to critical media literacy education. We also have seen, we've seen other solutions, right? We've seen other attempts to fix the problem. We already talked about those, the lists. So we have the fact checkers, limited. You can never scale up the problem. You'd have to hire millions of people to fact check round the clock all the sites, all the social media. I mean, it's just, again, a wash in a sea of information. Blacklists. Well, we already talked about Proper Not. There were a couple professors, Melissa Zimdars, Katie Starbird. They started trying to come up with metrics to rate news sources, but they use these labels like fake news or conspiracy site. Big problem with conspiracy is terminology, and if you don't know about it, you can take Peter Phillips' Sociology of Conspiracy class here. He teaches it every spring. Conspiracy theory was a weaponized term that came out of the CIA in the 1960s after the JFK assassination and the Warren Commission report. You can go back and read the memo 1035-960 that purposely calls attention to the term and requests that Mockingbird journalists do everything in their power to ignore any academic books that criticize the problems of the Warren Commission report. And if you can't ignore the books and can't not review the books, then you can attack the authors by calling them paranoid or conspiracy theorists. So anybody that walks around today and uses the term conspiracy theory to discredit somebody, let's just stop that. Let's retire that term, too. There may be conspiracy theories that aren't true or are fake news, but there are also plenty of conspiracies that are very real and true, based on evidence. How do we determine whether or not that a certain conspiracy is real or true? Well, we have to look at the facts. We have to go through the thought process. So blacklisting is also an old tactic, but it also leaves us needing and wanting more. Blacklisting tries to shut down debate, and what we're saying at Project Censored and our joint organizations that we work with, like the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, with other media literacy organizations, we think that we need debate. Debate is part of the solution. Having different perspectives and verifying facts, that's all part of the solution. Blacklisting and labeling and attacking shuts that down. Okay, how about this one? You knew that there were going to be proposed laws about all this stuff, right? You knew that was coming. Here's one. California Assembly Member Ed Chow. And this is our friend Dave Moss from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, rightfully tearing apart this horrible idea. Ed Chow proposed a bill to ban fake news. It was AB 1104. Anybody hear about that? It is unlawful for a person to knowingly and willingly make, publish, or circulate on an internet website or cause to be made, published, or circulated in any writing posted on an internet website a false or deceptive statement designed to influence the vote on either of the following: any issue submitted to the voters in an election, any candidate for election to public office. Any problems with that? Who's going to figure this out? Publish or circulate on an internet website? That's like a student paper gets turned in and they cite a source and they're just like, I found it in the library. That's a big place. You're going to troll the entire internet. I mean, again, it's an absolute unconstitutional attempt to shut down free speech and expression. And by the way, Chow's proposal was so roundly savaged on said internet, they actually withdrew the bill. So that was good. But we certainly at least should be noticing that there are concerted efforts being made to literally legislate this kind of stuff. And that's probably not something we want. See if this sounds familiar. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. We can stop there. So legislating this kind of issue is not going to solve the problem either. And of course, I've already talked a little bit about some of the history of propaganda and why it's a challenge and a problem. But that's also why I want to conclude with a reiteration of our solution. And I firmly believe that the solution to the so-called fake news crisis we face is more critical media literacy education. I say it over and over again because in the United States there is no K-12 program mandated to teach children critical media literacy skills. Does that mean some teachers don't do it? There's some teachers that do it, right? But it's a luck of the draw. Or unluck of the draw, you get me, right? And you're like, oh, this guy, that's all he's talking about. There are reasons for that. There's no college requirement. There's no GE requirement. Now, some will say, oh, it's critical thinking. Yeah, but it's not always focused on media, news media, entertainment media. It's not always focused there. And I say this because there are numerous countries around the world, throughout Asia, throughout Europe in particular, that have long made media literacy part of their social educational fabric. But here, well, that would be counterproductive to the ruling establishment manufacturing of consensus. Now, wouldn't it? We don't want a whole bunch of independent thinkers running around. That'd be awfully hard to corral, kind of like herding cats. We need people to watch the news when it's owned by six corporations. And we need those six corporations to control 90% of what you hear and read and see. And we need to attack and label and create blacklists and censor and inundate people with obfuscating language about fake news. Because otherwise, people might start to figure things out. And that's sort of the silver lining of the great catastrophe of the last year, is that people are saying, wait a minute. I didn't understand this, and why was the news not asking these questions? And we've got a whole chorus of mea culpas coming from the corporate media. We should have asked tougher questions. We should have been there. We failed. And now, get these hypocrites. You go and look at the Washington Post or the New York Times. I get this stuff coming into my inbox all the time because I read it all the time. And they're actually riffing. They're now running advertisement campaigns about how they're going to fix everything because they're all about reporting the truth. At least several times a week, I get an email from the New York Times subscription people saying, you've come to trust the Times to tell you the truth. And again, the first thing that comes to my mind every time is Judith Miller and the 1.5 million dead Iraqis that spun from that lie and the 5 million refugees that came out of that war. That's still going on. And by the way, that reminds me of the AP running alternative facts about how, quote, only 87,000 people died in Iraq. And even at the time they were claiming that, the number was already up to over 1 million. So these fake news, propaganda, disinformation, these have consequences. And if it's not just the outcome of a particular election per se, right, that there have been studies showing like fake news didn't really cause that. Well, not fake news in the sense that a 19-year-old Macedonian kid is pumping out fake news for ad money on Facebook or Google, but let's call it by its right name, propaganda. Propaganda was thick all during the election season, and that is what is persuading people one way or another. And guess what? There's even a great disappointment emerging from some of the Trump supporters and voters, right? When it comes time to change tax code or it was time to repeal Obamacare, right? And, of course, we saw a bunch of people saying, like, I like the Affordable Care Act, but I'm not against Obamacare. That's the product of a propaganda system. Those are the same things, of course. But now, all of a sudden, these people are saying, like, he's going to take away the health care. Right? And you're just like, well, why did you vote for it? We didn't know. Okay, so this is not a moment to point and say, you're stupid. This is a point to say, we have a problem here of establishing information integrity. Fortunately, even though we have our little definitions up here, fortunately, we have people that establish information integrity checklists, like librarians. This is why education is part of the solution here. If you can teach people how to check the veracity of sources and claims, this is just 2 pages long, and ask basic critical questions. This is on our Global Critical Media Literacy website, which, by the way, we started 2 years ago. I helped co-author this, the Global Critical Needs Literacy Project Educators Resource Guide. It's online at gcml.org for free. And it goes through all the kind of assignments we use at Project Center that our friends at ACME, the Action Coalition for Media Education K-12 use, the graduate program we work with at Sacred Heart University in Connecticut on media literacy and digital culture, the only one of its kind in the country that specializes in critical media literacy education and social justice movements for Social Justice Week. You know, by the way, a lot of the stories that were propagandized and marginalized out of the frame of the election cycle were social justice stories, stories of Black Lives Matter, the Dreamers, Standing Rock, the Water Protectors. Those are social justice stories. Notice how they either don't get covered or their coverage is greatly skewed in the corporate press. That's not an accident. That's, again, all part of the paradigm of fake news. So we have solutions. In fact, we have even folks like our friends at TribeWorthy.com that just made this platform in the last 6 weeks. It is like a Yelp or Rotten Tomatoes for building trust among news sources. It's called crowd-contested media. Now, like Yelp or Rotten Tomatoes, it doesn't give you the be-all, end-all, but you can't really go to a restaurant anymore these days without hearing people talk about a Yelp review. You go and try to watch any movie on iTunes or Netflix or whatever, and the Rotten Tomatoes thing is embedded right in it, because people have grown to trust each other when saying, why did I like this, or why did I not like this, or what was good about this, or what was not good about that. So they've created a platform that uses critical media literacy skills and analysis for people to start to judge or rate news sources the same kind of way you'd rate these other things. Of course, it's new and it needs a lot of users, but these are folks from the allegedly apathetic millennial generation. Remember how the millennials were also blamed for the election outcome, right? I was like, gee, that's strange. I seem to remember a lot of enthusiasm among millennials until the Democratic convention. And then there was a lot of young people kind of saying, like, what happened? How could this guy be attracting 30,000 people in every city he goes to and we never even see this other person? And these leaked emails show that they were rigging the system. How can this happen? Well, how it can happen is propaganda. How it can happen is elite control of our political system and media. And the antidote to that is not just media democracy in action, it's people getting access to accurate information because they can think critically and independently on their own, and then they can go and share that information. And instead of sharing likes and clicks and fake news on Facebook or Twitter, you can actually start sending things to people that are vetted, and that are factual, and that are accurate, and that matter. You can be an aggregator of falsehood, you can be an aggregator of truth. That's a choice. And if you are a critical thinker, and if you have critical thinking skills based on critical media literacy education, you are the solution to these problems. The time for outsourcing these problems, whether it be legal, corporate, whether we be asking the social media platforms to fix this for us, no. We don't need to ask. We can fix it on our own. And another way we can do it journalistically is by supporting independent journalism and by being the media ourselves. And there's a lot of power that we have as people in this society to change things. We have to be committed to changing them. We have to be informed and aware about what needs changed. But I would like to close with a fantastic quote from over 20 years ago from the founder of Project Censored, Carl Jensen. Jensen wrote, "Since we will all benefit from a more responsible media, we all really should help bring it about. To do this, the corporate media owners should start to earn their unique First Amendment privileges. Editors should rethink their news judgment. Journalists should persevere in going after the hard stories. Journalism professors should emphasize ethics and critical analysis and turn out more muckrakers and fewer buckrakers. The judicial system should defend the freedom of the press provision of the First Amendment with far more rigor, and the public should show the media it is more concerned with the high crimes and misdemeanors of its political and corporate leaders than it is with the crimes and gossip of celebrities. The effort will be well worth it." I couldn't agree more, and I think now more than ever, the effort is well worth it. Thank you very much.
One, two. conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians. Cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaigns. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips and I are executive producers of the program, while Anthony Fest is our producer. Nolan Higdon and Nicholas Baham III are co-hosts, as is Desiree McSwain. Our intern is Alicia Farrardo. The Project Censored Show airs on nearly 40 stations around the U.S., from Maui to New York. All of our shows are archived online at projectcensored.org. To learn more about the show, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time. Up next, Terra Verde.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Theocracy versus Democracy. The Political Uses of Religion. Michael Parenti says that democracy can't survive under religious rule, whatever that religion may be. Parenti's warning in this archival recording is as timely and urgently expressed as it was when this speech was first given during the second term of the Reagan administration. It is easy to extend this timeless analysis to the present circumstances. This talk is also very funny. You will hear why God may be one of the founding fathers and what Woody Allen had to say about him. Here's Michael Parenti.
Thank you, everyone, for having me here today. A few years ago, I went on a yoga retreat in the Caribbean, a little island. It's an ashram where people practice yoga. I went because I like yoga. Unfortunately, the head of the whole, this yoga sect was there, a very religious man, and he gave sermons every morning, which the guests were required to attend. And every day he talked about love and the higher cosmic force of love. Every day he talked about how spiritual things are everything and material things are nothing. And then one day his yacht got loose from the pier and it began to float away. And he started to scream and said, "Get my yacht, get my yacht." And he had a yacht and he had a seaplane. And this man of love, I noticed, was filled with hate. He yelled at people. He kicked out a couple of people from the place because they raised some questions, and he threatened to bring the police in. And it occurred to me that this Swami was the perfect theocrat, that what we had here was a theocracy, using the power of the state to enforce your will, countenancing no alternative opinions, and up to your ears in wealth. In a theocracy, there's no democracy. Now, religionists say that they're anti-materialist. They're against materialism. But that word materialism is a very funny one. It's subject to a number of misinterpretations. In fact, there are two real, quite different uses for the word. There's philosophical materialism, which argues, as you know, that ideas do not exist as independent forces, independent of material reality, as disembodied mystical forces. As the great materialist Karl Marx said, men sometimes get ideas in their head and they're so vivid that they then impute to these ideas an external existence of their own as some force out there. Now, the religionists, to be sure, are anti-materialist in that sense. That is, they believe in these spirits and they believe in these externalized imaginings. But there's a second use of the word materialism. And we often use it, I think, instinctively, quite correctly. We associate it with consumerism, self-interest, power, possessiveness. what I would call acquisitive materialism. And now here, most religious organizations really are very dedicated to this kind of materialism. They acquire throughout the centuries, they have acquired, and in many different cultures, in many different countries, in many different eras, the one thing all these religions have had in common, almost all of them, is that they have acquired vast properties and wealth, and they have used political power. They've used the legitimated authority of the state, the legal use of organized force and violence, which is Max Weber's definition of the state. They've used political power to advance their own material interests, to win gain for themselves, to exploit people, and in fact to maybe often win advantages over competing religious sects, because there are often fights between each other. And for centuries they've been involved in secular intrigues, in conflicts, in wars, in ways that have often violated their own religious precepts. Let me give you just one example from the thousands of examples from history that I could give you. Martin Luther. Now, we all know the Martin Luther who started the Reformation with his anti-materialist rebellion against Rome. But there's another lesser-known Luther, the other materialist kind of Luther, the apologist for the German princes, the defender of the aristocratic class rule, the Martin Luther who, in 1525... when the peasants were starving, when their land had been taken, when they couldn't even get a decent amount of firewood to heat themselves, when their children were going hungry, when the rents were crushing them, and they were desperate, and they rose up in rebellion in 1525, and they took over the cathedrals, and they took over the castles, and they formed committees, and they reorganized the use of the wealth, and they reorganized the use of the land for themselves, and they rose up with dignity. That Martin Luther got up, and this is what he said. He said, this is a blasphemy. He cursed the rebellion for turning, quote, everything upside down like the worst disaster. By the way, his own prince, Frederick the Wise, says this. Let me quote him first. He said, in many ways, the poor folk have been wronged by the rulers. Take something when a prince admits that. And now God is visiting his wrath upon us. But not Luther. Luther knew which side God was on, and God is on the side of the aristocracy. And he said, I'll quote him, is everything upside down like the worst disaster. And Martin Luther repeatedly urged, quote, everyone who can to, quote, smite, slay, and stab the peasants, secretly or openly, remembering that nothing can be more poisonous, hurtful, or devilish than a rebel. It is just as when one must kill a mad dog. And, of course, he quoted numerous passages from the Bible to justify his call to butchery. And the German princes didn't need too much encouragement. They slaughtered 100,000 peasants. Historians agree that that's pretty much the estimate that could stand. So this Luther, the great spokesman for the one true God of love and the Prince of Peace, was up to his neck in homicidal bloodletting in a repressive class war on the side of those who have more than they know what to do with against those who want a fair shake. Now, sometimes it works the other way. Sometimes the religionists use the state to advance their interests. That's what we mean by the religious uses of politics. And sometimes the state uses religion to legitimate its own exploits, and that's the political uses of religion. So politicians use religion, and religionists use politicians. This is not to say that nothing's changed. Indeed, there have been remarkable historical developments over the centuries. There have been remarkable victories for our forces. There's been a rollback of theocratic power, I mean, compared today to the 10th century, let's say. The diminishment of religious wars in the West, and the secularization of social life with the advent of science and with such forces as industrialization, urbanization, and modern socialism. But these advances don't come, and history doesn't work in a neat historical succession. Just when we think it's going one way, much to our dismay, it starts going another way. And also right here in America, as the previous speaker pointed out, there has been a real resurgence of this religious right. For generations, religionists have served corporate capitalism. They've preached obedience to the status quo. They've opposed workers trying to organize and form unions. They've opposed syndicalism, socialism. It was portrayed as the work of the devil. And in turn, capitalists, the big rich robber barons and the owners, were inclined to present themselves as the recipients of the deity's highly selective blessings. Let me quote one of them. John D. Rockefeller Sr., quote, "I believe the power to make money is a gift of God. Having been endowed with the gift I possess, I believe it is my duty to make money and still more money and more money and more money and more money. And to use the money I make for the good of my fellow man according to the dictates of my conscience." So from this we may conclude that God is a financier. And so too today, social and political leaders constantly call upon God. Every president of the United States feels compelled to do this. But no president more so than Ronald Reagan. And it's a little scary. You know, it's one thing for certain right-wing evangelicals to announce that the Bible prophesies an imminent apocalypse, that we are now in the third and final stage, the third and final millennium, that the Antichrist forces from the East, as portrayed by Gorbachev in Russia, will meet destruction, Israel will convert, and Christ will return triumphant to deliver death upon the non-believers and elevate the believers up to eternal life into heaven. It's one thing to hear that from Jerry Falwell and Jimmy Swaggart. It's quite something else when the President of the United States, the guy with his finger on the button, tells us that he embraces the same mythology. Well, they say that the Russians are scared of Reagan, and I don't doubt it because so are many Americans. It's one thing when the fundamentalist Reverend Bailey Smith, then president of the Southern Baptist Convention, tells a right-wing political rally that God, quote, does not hear the prayer of a Jew. God is an anti-Semite, it turns out. It's something else when the president of the United States announces that the United States is, quote, a Christian nation. And this surely must come as news to a loyal citizenry, which includes over 6 million Jews, several million Hindus, Muslims, and Buddhists, and millions upon millions of atheists, agnostics, skeptics, and non-sectarian deists, who together probably compose a majority of our people. It's something when Reagan gets up there at his State of the Union message and says, "This country and our Constitution could not have been formulated without divine guidance." So I sit there and I'm saying, so God is not only our father, he's our founding father. As a matter of fact, the Constitution is very clear on this. The framers at Philadelphia left the deity very much out of it. And when Benjamin Franklin suggested that their daily sessions should open with a prayer asking for divine guidance, they voted it down. And Alexander Hamilton said, "We don't need foreign aid."
This is the voice of Dr. Michael Parenti. You're listening to a rebroadcast of his talk, Theocracy versus Democracy, The Political Uses of Religion, recorded on April 12, 1987, in Denver, Colorado. That was near the end of the second term of Ronald Reagan. Prepared for rebroadcast in early 2017, because it still sounds as if it was given yesterday.
The Constitution is very clear that ours is not a Christian nation. Article 6 reads, quote, "No religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States." And by the way, that was a distinct and democratic advance for one who has a very critical view of the Constitution, who feels it wasn't a very democratically motivated Constitution. Let's say that was a democratic victory for the people. It was even ahead of many state constitutions, which in those days banned Jews, Catholics, and non-believers from holding public office. And of course, the most democratic victory came not with the founding fathers, but with the concession they had to make, they were forced to make because of those democratic forces, and that was the Bill of Rights. When Colonel Mason of Virginia got up and said, "Let's have a Bill of Rights," that was voted down almost unanimously. I think Massachusetts abstained. Later on, they realized their tactical error. And they realized if they wanted to get this thing ratified, and if they're going to win some kind of popular support for it, they'd better give the people something besides what they gave themselves in the Commerce Clause and all those other goodies and bills and credits and all the other stuff for themselves. They had to give the people something, and they put through a Bill of Rights with the First Amendment. We're witnessing not only the religionist use of politics, but the politician's use of religion. Take that issue of abortion. These guys don't care one way or another about abortion. As a matter of fact, they had the opposite position. A matter of fact, conservatives for years supported legal abortion because their view was that the poor had too many babies and was too many kids on welfare, so let's have abortions, get rid of those kids. That was their position for years. Ronald Reagan, when he was governor of California, he signed the most liberal abortion bill in the world. And his daughter had an abortion, didn't bother him at all. George Bush supported legal abortions. They've all changed now. They've all come over. And why they came over? Because they found political gold in that area. Because Richard Viguerie got up and said, hey, this is how we can split the Democratic Catholic vote. Hey, this is how we can win more of the Protestant fundamentalist vote. And Viguerie even said it. When Reagan appointed Sandra O'Connor, he said, is she soft on abortion? We cannot give up this issue. This issue helps us split the Democrats. I mean, it is the crassest case of political opportunism. Once more, as in Luther's day, using religion as an instrument of maintaining your power, religion as an instrument of class control. And Reaganism has brought forth not only the politically more conservative religious spokesmen, but also the theologically more reactionary ones. Those who evade all real social issues. You can watch these guys on television all day. You'd never know there was something called pollution, or acid rain, or poverty, or exploitation, or unemployment, or inflation, or unfair tax laws, ruinous tax laws. You never get a sense of that. You never get a sense that people are desperate, fighting, trying to stay ahead of themselves, wondering how they're going to get through their old age. You never get any of that. All you know is that you're to blame, you're weak, and all you got to do is open up your heart to Jesus, and it'll all be saved. It'll all be worked out. They have no attention to poverty, oppression, to militarism. What they do is focus on personal pieties, sectarian intolerance, and a kind of prudish, repressive moralism. In the face of all the things we have to struggle with today, they're targeting Playboy magazine. Their message is the same as it's been for centuries, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters. Don't organize and struggle for social justice and against the powers that be, against the powers that exploit you, against the powers that take the money out of your paycheck before you can even get it home. Don't fight against them. Just trust in God and God's love, and above all, keep those contributions coming in. And what a God it is they sell. We already know from reading the Bible that the Judeo-Christian God is vainglorious, sadistic, murderously partisan, vindictive. In fact, if you had a person like that, you wouldn't want to associate with him for 5 minutes, let alone worship him. You might recall that God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, including all the unoffending and innocent children and infants in those cities, because he didn't like the lifestyle of certain of the citizens and what they were doing. He took great satisfaction when his Israelites acted like imperialists and massacred. Read the Book of Kings where he says, and the Israelites slew 20,000. When the first time I read that, I was astonished. I said, my God. And God was pleased. And the Israelites went out and they slew 35,000 and killed them all. And God was happy. I said, my God, what a God. Not my God. And I'm saying to myself, but this God is Caligula. This God is one of or some other homicidal mad despot. We also know that God is a terrorist and an extortionist. Listen to Oral Roberts, who says that God's going to zap me unless they come up with 8 million smackers by the end of March. There's the Baptist minister Everett Sullivan. Now this guy ran in the Republican primary for governor in Nebraska. Four candidates, he came in fourth. And a woman won. So what did Sullivan says? He says, this was a curse, evidence of God's curse. Quotes from the Bible, the good book, right? The good book, Jeremiah. Jeremiah plainly tells us that when the people of a nation are willing to accept the leadership of a woman, it is a sure sign of God's curse, unquote. Talk about a sore loser, huh? Well, we always knew God was a male supremacist, too. Now, the point I want to make here is less a theological one than a political one. It's that the crude religionism of the right demonstrates not only the obviously anthropomorphic origin of the God image, but also the exploitative, opportunistic use of religion as an instrument of oppression, as an instrument of material acquisition, as an instrument of political power and political privilege. It is not merely that the God hucksters are silly and superstitious. Rather, they are keenly self-interested, manipulative, and politically powerful. Not only do the religionists preach pie in the sky by and by, but they live high off the hog here and now. While preaching otherworldliness to their followers, they're up to their ears in the crassest pursuits of wealth, power, class interests, and if we can believe what's happening to Jimmy Baker, other crass pursuits. They talk about doing good for others, but they do well for themselves. However, as I say, although history moves in fitful and often uncertain steps, the general thrust has really been forward. Important democratic victories have been won. Theocratic forces still menace us. They enjoy unexpected resurgence, but they no longer rule over the Western world the way they once did. Also today, in about a third of the world, in existing socialist countries, in communist countries, the oppressive, horrible, totalitarian Congress countries, theocracy has been thoroughly vanquished, which is not to say that religion is prohibited. Every traveler who's gone there, including Billy Graham, says that people are free to practice their religions. And there's freedom for synagogues, churches, for Baptists, Jews, Church of Christ, Roman Catholic denominations. The misrepresentation in the West on this issue, and it's constant that religion isn't free in the USSR or other communist countries. It's, again, another political use of the religious issue, because for the religionist, communism is a threat, not only because atheism is not tolerated, but because atheism has an official status as a creed. And this is what the religionists cannot forgive. It's kind of ironic, you know. In evil totalitarian Russia, atheism has achieved a pluralistic safeguard superior to what is found in our own supposedly democratic pluralistic society. And there's more open, unharassed freedom of belief in communist countries for religious believers than there is for atheists in the USA. We can also witness a new revolutionary development within the ranks of religion itself, especially in Latin America, with liberation theology. And the threat of liberation theology is that it doesn't diminish man to God, but puts him as the center of God's concern, and it also speaks for the interests of a different social class from the one that religionists usually represent. Liberation theology is not for theocracy, but against it. It's not for what the French call le prêtre du double menton, the priest of the double chin. It's for the hungry and the immiserated. To the extent that liberation theology has this democratic social content, it represents an historically progressive development, even if we can still disagree with them theologically about things. Instead of conjuring up a god who is the object of pietistic idolatry and interior imaginings, liberation theology sees God as manifest in social justice, in economic betterment for all the people, a more decent life here on earth, so that the lowliest among us shall be among the best, and the parasitic, the exploitative, the oppressors, the plutocrats, the dictators shall be cast aside. That's really a subversive religion. That's really getting close to what Christianity really is supposed to be about. And also in the USA, there's a Christian left that's developed, it's emerged, which sides with the poor, with the political refugees from fascism and the peace movement, and which does not support the kind of Reagan restrictions, the kind of breaking down of church and state walls, and the kind of restrictions on other people's creeds. So for some believers, at least, it seems that God is not a jingoist or a militarist or a financier, but he's a pacifist and a progressive and maybe even a revolutionary. So it becomes clear that God is about as good as the people who believe in him, which is understandably so, since he is made in their image. My own view on God is the one that's offered by the great American theologian Woody Allen, who once said that maybe God does exist, but he's an underachiever. Imagine being omnipotent and producing this, right? Tornadoes, plagues, fascists, all these things. Well, what is to be done? Three short points, then I'll sign off. The immediate goals that we might consider worth struggling for. First, we have to get the religionists off welfare. Make the rich churches and the multimillionaire TV evangelists pay a fair share of taxes on their immense holdings and investments. We have to get their loving, beseeching, hands, we got to get those hands out of our pockets. Stop this theocratic rule where the state forces us to subsidize them in their propagandizing of their faith, which is a violation of our beliefs and a violation of the Constitution that is using the state in that way. Not propagating their faith, they can do that. Second, free thinkers, liberation theologists, atheists, agnostics, etc., should have equal time on television. I just wrote a book called Inventing Reality, which deals with the way that political ideas and information are controlled by the news media, but the same thing could be said about creed. Alternative views are systematically shut out. Dissident opinions get no hearing. I mean, occasionally a local radio show, Madeline Murray O'Hare will be interviewed or someone else like that. But for the most part, you could just see that it's not a non-secular TV. Dissident opinions get no hearing. There's no free market of ideas. Third, we must roll back Reaganism and its war against the First Amendment and its war against the separation of church and state and against our freedom and our beliefs. And that we can... And I think the Reaganites have been weakened by the Iran-Contra scandal, and so there are new opportunities for us to fight back. Not just to complain, but to fight back, and not to feel that they're all so powerful and they're so dangerous. Not, they're dangerous, it's true, but you have to do what the great Italian communist Antonio Gramsci once said, and what Madeline Murray O'Hare practiced, even though I bet she didn't read Gramsci on this point. He said, you must have a pessimism of the mind, be able to see the worst, the dangers, and an optimism of the will to fight back and know that there are victories that we could win and more of them will be ours. Even though some of us may not realize it, we are part of very much of a long historical struggle. We are involved in making history, just a little bit of it, maybe a paragraph was made right out there today. To those who would make the world safe for hypocrisy, we say that our country needs something more than freedom of religion. We need freedom of belief, including the freedom not to believe in spirits and demons without putting our jobs and civil liberties at risk. Our historic task is not to vanquish religion, but to vanquish theocracy, I think, and with it, all the abuses and privileges upon which it feeds. This, ladies and gentlemen, would be, and it will be, a great victory for humanity and for democracy. Thank you.
That was an archival speech by Michael Parenti on Theocracy versus Democracy, The Political Uses of Religion. He was recorded in Denver, Colorado on April 12, 1987, at the American Atheist National Convention. With roots in a working-class Italian district of New York City and a PhD in political science from Yale, Michael Parenti is an internationally known writer and lecturer. He's the author of 23 books. Please find a pen to write down a phone number to call to find out how to order the extended version of this speech, a 45-minute CD of Michael Parenti on the political uses of religion. This program is also available as film on DVD. Visit TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. For links to Michael Parenti's website and more information, TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD or DVD order keeps this program on the air. You can find a free download of the 29-minute version of this talk on TUC Radio's website or call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to the Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. This week, we'll be speaking with anti-war and social justice activist, writer, and researcher, Allison Bodine. Allison particularly is well-informed about what is going on in Venezuela, current events, and trends in Latin America. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with Allison Bodine. Allison Bodine, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you. Very happy to be here with you this morning, Cindy.
Well, thank you. You're what I consider my house expert on what's happening in Venezuela and what's going on. And the people of Venezuela are something that's very important to me. And I think it should be important to everybody because it's kind of a microcosm of what's happening around the world. But it's also something that we who consider ourselves revolutionary socialists in the United States, we can like look at Venezuela, especially the early, the beginnings of the Bolivarian Revolution, and be inspired by the energy and the love of Hugo Chavez, the former president who passed away. The love of him for his people and for the history and the culture and the, the country of Venezuela. And then in return, the energy and love of the people towards him. So I just really love Venezuela, but I hate what the U.S. and the U.S. sponsored Organization of American States is doing to the people of Venezuela.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, Cindy. That's a lot why I am been inspired by Venezuela. We're now in the 19th year, actually, of the Bolivarian Revolution.
Amazing.
It's really been an incredible change for poor, working, and oppressed people in Venezuela. But that inspiration, the way that the Venezuelan Bolivarian Revolution has really joined with other countries across Latin America and the Caribbean, with revolutionary Cuba and then other countries joining on, I think that's really the motivation for these U.S.-sponsored threats against Venezuela, for the United States' attempts to destabilize the country, to overthrow President Nicolas Maduro today, is really to try and isolate that influence that revolutionary Venezuela's had on so many millions of people. And I think that's the crux of what we're talking about when we talk about reasons for U.S. Intervention in Venezuela.
Well, poor Nicolas Maduro, I mean, he really stepped into huge shoes. He had enormous shoes to fill. From Chavez, who was beloved and who did have incredible energy to fulfill the wishes of the Venezuelan people, because the Venezuelan Constitution was written by the people, and the only way it can be amended is by the people. So Maduro had these enormous shoes to fill, and he really has been embattled from within and without, hasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, it's years of an economic war that really the United States and the capitalist class in Venezuela saw the fall in oil prices, which was dramatic, as we know and have all noticed, as the opportunity to really increase their attacks and begin using the economy to try and convince the people of Venezuela to overthrow their government and reverse the gains of the Bolivarian Revolution. So the economic war that President Nicolas Maduro and the United Socialist Party of Venezuela and all the mechanisms of the Bolivarian Revolution have been fighting against has manifested itself through hoarding by Venezuela's major corporations. I mean, one thing the mainstream media is constantly leaving out is that when they talk about shortages in Venezuela, they don't recognize that it's actually the counter-revolutionary opposition and the capitalist class in Venezuela that controls most of the production and distribution of food and basic items in Venezuela. So they'll talk about the shortage of corn flour in Venezuela, but not recognize that The companies that produce that have actually reduced their production and have been found to be hoarding massive amounts of this basic foodstuff in order to try and essentially starve the people of Venezuela. There's many reports that you can read online about, you know, in the rich areas of Venezuela, you can go and find all the corn flour, cheese, milk, whatever you would like, when they have people standing in long lines outside of government-sponsored grocery stores or just your store down the street waiting for these basic goods. So there's been hoarding, there's been price gouging. There's also a major issue of the fact that in Venezuela, one of the big gains of the Bolivarian Revolution was to make these basic goods affordable to people. And so the prices went down on the shelves. But people are buying these subsidized goods, smuggling them into Colombia and selling them at hundreds of times the price that they sell for in Venezuela. So people are making massive amounts of money off of the backs of the people of Venezuela. So there's this economic war, like I said, that is taking advantage of the drop in oil prices in order to try and further strangle the Venezuelan economy. And then the United States, at the same time, in conjunction, has few years ago, 2015, and again in 2016, both under U.S. President Barack Obama, declared Venezuela to be an extraordinary threat to the national security of the United States.
That's so crazy. Just on the face value of it, it's just lunacy.
Thousands of miles away. Caracas is something like 3,000 miles away from Washington, D.C. The U.S. military is, of course, stationed right off the coast of Venezuela. And yet somehow Venezuela and the people, the 30 million people there, are a threat to the United States. The real impact of this has been that it's allowed the U.S. Congress to increase their sanctions against Venezuela because the country has been given this status through an executive order. And then it has also really the moves of the U.S. like this scare away international creditors. So Venezuela is going through a crisis. They've experienced a lack of revenue due to the drop in oil prices, something that many countries around the world may experience. And they've also at the same time been cut off from international funding to help them get through the crisis by the U.S. government, essentially. So that's been another leg of the economic war against the people. And then I would say also what Maduro has been facing as president of Venezuela is also really just constant U.S. threats, especially in the last since we'll say February, the last few months. There was a letter written by U.S. Congress people, some of the most notorious, definitely, including Ted Cruz, Ileana Ross Lathan, people that forever have been fighting against the Cuban Revolution. Right. 34 members of U.S. Congress signed a letter in February, essentially calling on the U.S. government to do more to sanction and to put international pressure on Venezuela to change their system. They framed it, of course, in terms of human rights, democracy, but these terms, whether we look at Libya or Syria or Iraq or even the U.S.'s own history in Latin America, is not what the U.S. is concerned about.
Well, speaking of the U.S. Congress, I knew I didn't like Bernie Sanders before, but when he called Chavez a dead communist dictator, that was like the red line in the sand for me. I knew I could never support anybody who claimed to be a socialist, but who denounced in the most vicious and inflammatory terms somebody who was actually working towards a socialist future. Somebody, I wouldn't say Chavez was, you know, I don't think Venezuela is completely socialist, but certainly was working towards that. I was so upset when Sanders said that about him. The dictator part was what really bothered me, because like you said, they couch these things in terms of democracy, but I met with Chavez one time, and he said that I think it was the president of Brazil at the time told Chavez that Chavez has an excess of democracy. There's always elections there, and they've always been certified to be completely legitimate.
Yeah, and that's what's been ironic about recent events especially. So you have, since April, really, the Organization of American States, which represents countries in the Caribbean and Latin America and includes the United States and Canada. So it's a regional body. It's existed since the 1940s, really discredited throughout Latin America, especially a history of, for example, completely supporting and actually organizing troops to support the U.S. invasion of the Dominican Republic, turning their head through basically all of Central America's U.S.-sponsored wars and all of the death and destruction and the disappeared in Argentina, in Chile, really completely a United States tool. And then you have, in the last few months, the new general secretary of this organization, a man named Luis Almagro, really proving himself to be a United States puppet. Completely obsessed with Venezuela. If you look over his social media accounts, his public statements, trying to condemn Venezuela for being undemocratic, for violating something that the Organization of American States created called their Inter-American Democratic Charter. This is something that is a complete affront to, like you said, the democracy that Venezuela has been building for these last 19 years. They have had multiple elections victorious for the Bolivarian Revolution. They've also lost two elections and won just in December of 2015, in which Venezuela now has a majority right-wing opposition National Assembly. And now what Almagro and his friends in the Venezuelan opposition are calling for is elections in Venezuela. Presidential elections are already scheduled for 2018. Mm-hmm. So it's actually against Venezuela's constitution, which, like you said, was decided upon and voted upon by the people, to call these elections early. What the real issue is that the opposition attempted, through constitutional process of a recall referendum, to overthrow President Maduro, and they completely failed. They collected signatures, 30% of which were proven to be very suspicious, to come from dead people without identification, minors. They were unsuccessful in carrying out this referendum, and now they're saying we need elections immediately, so which is actually unconstitutional. So it's actually the right-wing opposition that is undemocratic, that has strangled the National Assembly. Like I said, they control the National Assembly, which has now become an organization that's been incapable of passing any legislation. 15 out of the 16 so-called laws that the National Assembly have passed have been ruled unconstitutional by Venezuela's Supreme Court because they do things like try and privatize public housing. Which is against Venezuela's constitution. So that really needs to be more closely examined as far as the Organization of American States calling, their general secretary calling for invoking the so-called Inter-American Democratic Charter and demands for Venezuela to hold elections immediately.
What happened the other day when President Maduro was calling for Venezuelans to come out and in some kind of armed opposition?
So in April 19th, Nicolas Maduro and the United Socialist Party of Venezuela issued a call of people in Venezuela to the streets to defend the revolution. Venezuela was celebrating a national holiday, and there were fears that the right wing was mobilizing violent protests. Basically, since especially the last 3 weeks, it seems that the opposition is attempting to start what they did in 2014, which were violent street riots known as the Guarimbas. 43 people died during those events. There were street barricades. There were, you know, just really violent riots, essentially, that were calling for the exit, la salida of Nicolas Maduro. And in order to prevent that from happening again, then Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro called the people of Venezuela to the streets and did call on a strengthening of militias in Venezuela in defense of the revolution. So I think, you know, from the outside, we have to completely condemn U.S. intervention and understand that the people of Venezuela are mobilizing to defend the gains that they have made through the Bolivarian Revolution under Comandante Hugo Chavez and now today under Nicolas Maduro, and that the threats of violence of the opposition are real and proven. Opposition leaders, of which there are many different factions, have been attacking government institutions regularly, Supreme Court buildings, but also things like the Social Mission for Housing have come under attacks through you know, simple bombs or fireballs, those sort of things. Opposition members have been caught with weaponry. And there was just a recent article that I think is really important talking about evidence that was released of people in Venezuela reporting that they'd been paid large sums of money by different factions of the opposition to actually provoke violence in demonstrations. So the opposition really sees it as in their favor if they can, you know, if people die, if there is, you know, some security officials have died. About seven people have actually died in the last few weeks. And they really see it as further proof of the undemocratic nature of the government of Nicolas Maduro. And so they'll provoke as much violence as they can during these demonstrations. And I, for one, was really inspired by the mobilization of the people of Venezuela. It was, you know, the masses were out in the streets and I think very peacefully showed their strength and their support for the revolution in contrast to the violence of the opposition forces.
Well, the opposition in Venezuela, and it might not be exclusive to Venezuela, is very well funded, and they have a lot of media on their side. And not only that, being well funded, because they are the, you know, the wealthy, usually the wealthy class in Venezuela, but they're also well funded by United States organizations, and it's been proven, USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy and things like that are also funding the opposition. So for the people of Venezuela to still be able to mobilize in a large way against that, to me, is almost like a miracle, because they are fighting against massive forces that want to overthrow the Bolivarian Revolution.
Yeah, it's incredibly inspiring to look at the photos from April 19th. And I think those will continue. I mean, Venezuela has definitely to be on guard. We have many of the faces, for example, that were taking center stage during the 2002 attempted coup against Hugo Chavez. There was a coup attempt that was overturned in only 3 days,
right,
due to the power of the people of Venezuela. Chavez was immediately put back in power and the Bolivarian Revolution continued. And those same actors that tried to carry out that coup are appearing again and again in Venezuelan media today and out in the streets in Venezuela today. And so that is a very dangerous signal, especially, like you said, because in that 2002 coup attempt, much research has been put out there about the U.S. ties directly with those coup plotters. And so some those same ties can be made today, whether it's, you know, email records of former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, or it's simply things like an announcement from the U.S. Southern Command, which is the office that unites all the U.S. military forces in Latin America, who recently at the same time as the opposition is stirring up destabilization attempts in these protests, is saying things publicly like Venezuela's relationships with Russia, China, and Iran are now posing a threat to U.S. interests in the region, or that, you know, the situation in Venezuela is going to most likely cause regional intervention in the country. So those aren't veiled threats. Those are quite direct when it comes from the mouth of the U.S. government, and their ties directly to Venezuela's counter-revolutionary opposition are very clear. It's also important to note that Trump has also shown some signs of his continued attacks on Venezuela. There were some statements he said during the election, and now he has talked openly with the presidents of Chile and Brazil. Of course, the president of Brazil is as a result of a coup. Both right-wing governments, and they've talked openly about the situation in Venezuela. He's also met at the White House with the wife of a so-called political prisoner, Leopoldo Lopez, who's the head of one of these far-right political parties in Venezuela. Leopoldo Lopez is in prison because he has committed crimes of violence in Venezuela. He's not a political prisoner, but Trump has met with his wife and actually tweeted, of course, as is his style, calling for the release of political prisoners in Venezuela. So,
what about political prisoners in the United States?
There you go. I mean, the hypocrisy runs deep, as we know. And I know most progressive people have no doubts about Trump, but really understanding that it's the entire U.S. government and all of their, all of their offices and institutions that are really working against Venezuela today to try and overthrow the revolution. And we have to, as people that believe in, you know, in peace, that believe in justice, we really have to work to get the U.S. government to end their intervention and to talk to people about what's happening in Venezuela today.
One of Chavez's biggest mistakes, I think, looking back in hindsight, was that I think he was way too easy on the people who tried to murder him in 2002. He was hours away from being executed or assassinated, and they didn't spend very much time in prison or anything. And I understand why he did it. He wanted to heal. He wanted the country to heal from it. But the blowback to me is not. It's caused more harm, I think.
Yeah, well, like I said, those same faces are back, so it's hard to say these things in retrospect, but it's clear that the counter-revolutionary opposition in Venezuela, the U.S. has found their way to continue supporting them and funding them, and they're not going away. But as we saw, the people of Venezuela are going to keep up their fight, and not only against the opposition, but the people of Venezuela are also finding ways to continue the revolutionary process, to not allow this to stop them from, you know, providing housing, to getting around in some ways the economic war through community organization. And the military has now been tasked with helping to do food distribution and, things. It's a dynamic situation. But it is one that the U.S. has its hands all over, and we have to be vigilant from here in the United States or Canada. Of course, I will say as well that in the Organization of American States, it is the U.S. government, but also Canada, that have come out really leading the joining with these right-wing governments in Latin America to try and condemn Venezuela. And although the Organization of American States and Secretary General Luis Almagro are pretty broadly and widely seen as puppets of the U.S. interests, and I think it is significant to show almost the desperation of the opposition in Venezuela, that they have to go and meet with this quite meaningless organization in order to get their opinions heard on the international stage, and they have to so directly appeal for international intervention means that they're facing problems in Venezuela that they haven't been able to establish what they want to as far as overthrowing the government without this international help. And they're bold and they're direct, and they, you know, even one member of the opposition who holds some sort of public position, maybe a governor or something, I can't quite remember, he tweeted in the last few days claiming that President Maduro's police forces were using chemical weapons against protesters in Venezuela.
Oh, my God.
Obviously taking, trying to join on this bandwagon of what is happening in Syria today to provoke further U.S. direct intervention, which could come in the form of bombs, as
right.
we saw.
Right. I mean,
so,
what kind of person would say something like that? The U.S. has just recently bombed Syria with 59 Tomahawk missiles, dropped the mother of all bombs in Afghanistan. That just shows the bankruptcy and evilness of the opposition in Venezuela that would want to provoke something like that.
Yeah, exactly. I think they are very bold in that way. And we have to pay attention to these things. And like I said, look at who the Congress is meeting with, their travels to the United States, their meetings with President Trump. I mean, it's in the interest of the United States to overthrow the Bolivarian Revolution, and they're going to continue doing their work in that way until they're victorious or until they're completely defeated. And it's a lot up to the people of Venezuela to continue building their revolution. But we have to do the work here in the United States or in Canada
they're starving and there's great hardship. And all over Latin America, we've seen a lot of inspiring struggles against capitalism and imperialism. And I mean, they're on the front lines. They're being murdered. You know, union organizers in Honduras, environmental activists, Colombia. But we've seen I think a small right wing march in some of the governments. But Ecuador recently had a leftist victory.
Yeah, and I think that's significant. I think the ability of Venezuela to continue their building of international relations, like we were talking about in the beginning, this U.S. assault, their determination to overthrow the Bolivarian Revolution, is really to isolate the impact that the Venezuelan revolutionary process has had on Latin America. And so as much as they can to try and infiltrate these regional organizations, they will continue to do. So Venezuela's ability to keep building alliances with Cuba, with Ecuador, to continue building ALBA, the Bolivarian Alternative for the Americas, these are significant components of what Venezuela's doing in Latin America and will continue to do.
Well, Alison, we're running out of time. Is there anything you'd like to add that I might not have asked you?
Well, just thank you, Cindy, again. I agree with you a lot. Like, Venezuela is important to inspire people who believe in social justice and in the process towards socialism. It's something that we need to talk about more in media. It's really, I guess, you know, it's a media war against Venezuela. And so independent media like that you promote and build through Soapbox or all of our different connections is really significant to fighting against this media war. The entire capitalist class in Venezuela is uniting with mass media based in the United States and the U.S. government to really lay the land for further U.S. intervention in Venezuela. And that is something, if we look across Latin America, Middle East, Africa, that is characterizes our world today in a lot of ways. The U.S. is looking for more and more places to invade, to take their resources, and we have to join all of our allies together in the struggle against U.S. imperialism.
And the collaborators in Venezuela are traitors. They're traitors to the country, and they're traitors to humanity. Well, Alison, What's your website? Where can my listeners, the Soapbox listeners, get more information?
So to read articles that I have written and research I've been doing on Venezuela, you can go to www.firethistime.net. We're a social justice newspaper based in Vancouver, Canada, and I encourage people to find us at firethistime.net, or you can also find the newspaper on the issue website, or just contact me directly, of course, through Facebook or whatever other means.
Well, Alison Bodine, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox again and for your willingness to help us understand these issues.
Thank you, Cindy, for your time, and thank you to all of your listeners on Soapbox.
Thank you. That's it for this special edition of the Soapbox. I hope you check out Fire This Time and check out more of Alison Bodine's writings and other people who write for the newspaper. And as always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, and you for listening and supporting the show. Please go to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox and support the show. And check out my new live show every Tuesday at 6 p.m. Pacific at BBS Radio, and my new live show is called The People Speak with Cindy Sheehan. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to The Soapbox. Peace out for now.